Welcome, everyone. My name is Colin Hopkins. But before we start, I would like to respectfully acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land in which this Swinburne campus is located. And I want to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. I also acknowledge and respect the traditional owners of lands across Australia, their elders, ancestors, cultures, and heritage, and recognise the continuing sovereignties of all Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islander nations, always. Okay, for those of you, the thrill seekers amongst you, can I please ask you to turn your phones off, because you can keep your parents wondering where you are all day. So just please make sure your phone's turned off. During the presentation, Wendy will be walking around with a mic if you have a question that you really need to ask. But I'll encourage questions, but there are 350 people and I have a lot I want to get through today. So I would also suggest you might find it easier to come up and chat to me or anyone up the front during our breaks. My name is Colin Hopkins. I am a happily retired physics teacher, and I just want to emphasize the word happily retired. Okay. During my long career as an educator, I've won a couple of awards here and there, but I actually sat on the panels that set quite a few of the study designs for this current study design at the early stages. I was what they called a critical friend for this. I'm an exam marker, and I do a fair bit of what they call resolution marking for their, for that. So what I'd like to do today is to share that knowledge with you. I've got a couple of friends to come along to help me, and Albert will turn up in a couple of my videos today. This is what I'd like to try and achieve today. I'm going to stop at 10:50 and start at 11 so that the Zoom people can be well structured and organised and understand what we're doing.
And you know about that stuff?
Penny. I'm a physicist. I have a working knowledge of the entire universe and everything it contains.
Who's Radiohead?
Oh. I have a working knowledge of the important things in the universe. Good luck.
Today's about preparation. Today's about thinking before you act. And I would like to share a few ideas with you about what I think you should be doing in that respect. What I'd like to do is to talk to you about working smarter, not harder. And for me, there's three elements to it. The first thing is you need to know what you know. Then you need to know what you don't know. But that's where your improvement's going to come from, doing the work on what you don't know. Okay. When, before I retired, I used to teach at Bialik College. I was head of science at Bialik. And my kids, when I gave them work to do, they would be quite comfortable to hand an assignment in. And I say, oh, you didn't do question four. And I said, no, I know how to do it. And I would say, fine. Because if you know how to do it, you're actually not going to learn anything by doing it again. You're actually wasting your time, because your time can be spent doing the stuff you don't know. Mind you, my kids soon learnt they left questions out. That was what the sack was on, because I kept records of which ones they didn't do. But understand what you know, and you're not going to improve by constantly doing stuff that you already know how to do. It'll make you feel good, but it won't improve your knowledge. The next thing for me is a quality, not quantity, is the secret. And I stole this out of a paper the other day, and to be smart. Your revision needs to be specific. It needs to be measurable. It needs to be achievable, relevant, and it needs to be timely. So if you just have, if you've put those criteria to your thinking, is this smart? And then I think that will happen, that will help the process. And you need to practice the way you intend to perform on the exam. Hands up those people who've already started doing practice papers, trial papers. Keep your hand up if you always spend 15 minutes reading it before you start doing it. Oh, that's good. Only about a quarter of you kept your hands up. That's okay. What's my point with that? My point is that the reading time, that 15 minutes, is really important. Does anyone know how many pages there were in last year's paper? 42, I hear you say. Good. 15 minutes reading time, how long does that mean you get to read each page during reading time? Not long is your basic and mathematical answer, okay? So if you don't have a plan for reading time, you're going to waste that 15 minutes. My strong advice is this. Skip the multiple choice questions. Don't worry about them. Go straight to section B. Have a look at it. If you've seen the question, you've seen, I've seen that question before, don't read it. If you haven't seen it, read it. But if you've seen the question, you see that and said, oh, yeah, that's just, you know, there's a parallel plate. They want me to find the force on the charge. You're not going to learn anything by reading it, so don't read it. Skip the next question. Once you've read all section B, go to section A, the multiple choice. You're not reading them. You're starting to do them in your head. So you start doing them during reading time. You're not allowed to write anything. You're not allowed to touch a calculator or anything like that. But that's what you're going to do. And then as soon as you're allowed to start writing, you grab that little green sheet that you're going to get, this little sheet that looks like this one. Start filling this out. Okay, that's what you're going to do as soon as you're allowed to do that during reading time. That's a skill that you need to practice. It's not one that you are going to wait and leave and do for the first time ever when you're actually in the exam. Okay. When you're reading the paper, if that's a questionnaire, do you need to know during reading time, this is reading time, do you need to know that it is a single 9-volt battery, that it's got 10 loops, that the resistance is 6 ohm, that JK is 12 centimetres long, KL is 6 centimetres long, and the field is 0.5 T? No, because you're not going to remember it. You're going to have to read it again when you do the question. So reading that during reading time is wasting your time. So don't do it. Just have a look and see. They want me to find the size and the direction of the force on AF. Fine, I can do that. Next question. Be smart with your reading time. And it is the skill that you need to practice. What's the exam going to look like? 70% of it should be familiar if you've done enough past papers. 25% there for the high performance students, and 5% of the papers typically there to sort out the real cream up the top. Or basically, 25% of it's easy, 50% in the middle, and 25% of it's hard. Expect some hard questions. Don't get too fussed about them. If we analyse what the papers look like since the new study design, the one you're doing since 2017, basically about 50 to 60% have been calculations, 30 to 40% have been short answers, and 15 to 20%, I know that doesn't add up to 100, but, you know, roughly, are graphs and analysing information. Know what to expect, go in there and be prepared for what's going on. I'm not sure if your teachers have told you how the papers get marked. The first thing they do is they guillotine the edge of the paper, and then it all goes through a scanner. And then as a marker, I get 50 question ones on my screen. I mark them, I get 50 question twos, threes, fours, fives, et cetera. And once I've done them, I get another 50 question ones. What's the point? No one sees your whole paper. Okay, so no one actually gets to see your whole paper. So your writing needs to be legible, and it needs to be something that's scanned. So you're not going to write in pencil. You're going to write in a blue or black pen. I want you to have a look, and I want you to tell me, what's the number? That's the answer, the top left-hand corner. What number has been written there? My kids, I used to always take photos. When my kids used to do a Zach, I used to come in with this, and we used to have a guess my word competition before I'd give them their marks at all. And so this was us guessing word. Hands up those who can see 400 in that top left-hand corner. Who can see 900? Which one is it? Don't know. What about the number in the middle that's slightly hidden by this cross? Can I get rid of that? I don't know what's going
on. No, unfortunately, we can't.
All right, okay. Sorry, I can't do anything about that. Oh, yes, I can. All right. Is that a 3 or a 5? Yeah, yeah. What about the next number? Has the 8 been crossed out or is it there? Okay, all right. And what's the word? Can anyone guess the word? Anyone prepared to have a guess? Can you see a G?
Yes.
R-A-P-H. Yes, that's graph. Yep. Yep. So imagine this. It's 4 o'clock in the morning and I've been marking papers since 10 the night before, and I'm on to about my 300th cup of coffee and I get something like this. What am I going to say? Can we read the first line that sort of looks like F is equal to MA?
Yeah.
Now we've substituted the numbers in. Yep. It's a squiggle times a squiggle. Okay. And the answer is a blur. Okay. And then they've copied the blur into the answer box. When I'm marking the paper, the first thing I do is I look at the answer box. If it, depending on how many marks it's worth, if it's worth one mark, I look in the answer box, I can read it. You're right, fine, next question. If I can't read it in the answer box, I go and look at your working out. So when you're doing your working out, I would always recommend that you write it neatly and you actually spell it out. So I would always say, write your answer in the working out section and then copy your answer into the answer box, because that gives me two bites of the cherry when I'm trying to do it. When I'm trying to mark it, I am trying to give you marks, but I have to be able to justify what you've done, and you've got to show me what you're doing. Now, this is what I like, okay? This makes me feel good, all right? I can actually read it, and it's well-structured. What I would always recommend that you do is that you will notice that the formulas are written out for you. And then every number has been substituted in the correct order. It's showing me they know what R is. It's showing me they know what big M is. It's showing me they know what little M is. Okay? Great answer. That's what I want to see. You should have a look at the front paper, the front page of the paper, to know what you're going to get. You should read the instructions that are on the inside of what's going on. And you should also... You know, there's some instructions about section A telling you that, you know, you don't lose marks if you make an incorrect answer, so you don't leave anything blank at all. And for section B, it does say that you've got to use G is equal to 9.8, but if you're lazy and you use 10, you'll be fine. Okay, what are you allowed to bring into the calculator, into the exam? Your calculator and your cheat sheet. Here's a cheat sheet from many years ago, one of my year 11s brought in. And it was for a heating and cooling test back in the old days when we used to do it. And it was a 50-minute test. It was all calculations. And so at the end of the test, I said, can I borrow your cheat sheet? The student was really pleased and said, yes, yes. I've used it ever since as an example of this world's second worst cheat sheet. Which probably begs the question, what do I think the world's worst cheat sheet is? And that's the one some of you have used. It's the one that you borrow from a mate, photocopy, and say, that'll do me. Okay. It's a fairly common cheat sheet. How much effort have you put into it? None. How much value are you going to get out of it? about as much as you put into it.
Okay.
The chief assessor says that a lot of students lose marks because they contradict themselves. So be careful when you're doing that. You can get around that by using dot points. Okay, kids start off saying the current goes to the left, and then they prove it, and say, therefore, the current goes to the right. And you sort of think, as soon as you've done that, you cannot get full marks for the question. As soon as you contradict yourself, if the question was worth 3 marks, yours is now out of 2, because you cannot get full marks when you've done that. Your answer must relate to the question. A lot of students think that teachers, after a hard day teaching and their marking exams, feel like reading hundreds of words of crap. And so they copy everything that they put on their cheat sheet into the answer in the hope that the marker is going to read it all, find a word or two or a sentence or a little bit that they can get a mark for. You're wasting everyone's time, yours and the marker's. The chief assessor calls it data dumping, okay? And that's, he hates it. And we're working really hard to try and minimise it. Okay. In general, the questions that we if it's a 1 mark question, you get 1 mark for the correct answer. That's it. You don't look anywhere else. If it's a 1 mark question, it's either right or wrong. If it's a 2 mark question, the first mark is typically allocated for a correct formula and substitution, and 1 mark for the answer. If it's a 3 mark question, there's normally an initial derivation or a conversion of some information, 1 mark for the final formula / substitution, and 1 mark for the answer. There's always 1 mark for the answer. Oh, sorry. Everything that I'm saying, you don't need to write basically anything down. It's all in the notes. I have just lifted 99.9% of what you're seeing is straight out of the notes, okay? I've just lifted it out of the notes. 4 mark questions. The first mark's for the calculation or some recognition, substitution or statement, something. The second and the third marks are for process. They're not for outcome. So they're usually attached to you using a formula and substituting something in. So they're not contingent on the mark before it. For instance, if it was a momentum question, the first mark might be for saying that momentum is conserved, therefore the final momentum is equal to the initial momentum. Then the next mark is for you actually doing the calculations for doing that sort of thing. And for the four mark question, the fourth mark's always for the correct answer. I would advise you to avoid algebraic rearrangement of your formulas, because often the first mark or one of the early marks is for correct substitution into an appropriate formula. So if you write the formula out off the cheat sheet or off the formula sheet and then substitute the numbers in correctly, you often get the first mark. If you've rearranged the formula and mucked it up, forgot to square the bottom line or something like that, then you're not going to get that mark. So I always suggest you substitute, then you play with the numbers. We're going to talk about exam preparation. Theory suggests that you remember about 10% of what you hear, 25% of what you read, 40% of what you write, 70% of what you do, and 85% of what you teach. So clearly, if you want to maximise your performance in your revision process, you're going to get together with your mates. Oh, no, you're physics students. You don't have friends. You're nerds. All right, okay. Social media. Go to social media, find some friends, and then start working with them, okay? The best way for you to learn is to try and teach other people. I would also recommend you want to try teaching your parents. Next time they're giving you a hard time, tell them to sit down and say, we want to chat. This is my explanation of Young's double slit experiment. And this is why it demonstrates that light is a wave compared with a particle. And then the next night, or straight after, you can say, yeah, give them give them Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you know, give them something nice, and then sort of say, welcome to my world. This is what I get every day. Now leave me alone, okay? You know? All right. The revision process has, in my opinion, has got two steps. The first one is you need to master the content. And then the second one is you need to master the exam process. Hopefully most of you have just about finished the content and we're now ready to start doing revision. The notes I've prepared for you look like this. And there's a mountain of them. There's 20 sections of notes, okay? In each section of the notes, I've identified the dot point. I've cleared up the dot point to start off with. And then under the dot point, I've identified from these past papers, which are in current study design, these are the multiple choice questions, short answer questions, and these are the ideas that each of those questions have done. I've also told you what percentage basically got them right. And I've told you whether they're what sort of questions they are. So you can actually see how the examiner's asking you questions. Then in the notes, I've gone and said, okay, I've given you a bit of theory, a couple of pages of theory, not much. And then I've identified all the different aspects of the point of what the study design is wanting you to do. And for example, in section 3 on the worked example 8, which is this one on, it's a horizontal collision, and the question is it an inelastic or elastic collision? I've given you an example from a previous study design, but you can look at it and you can see, oh, this question was asked, 2022 question 7B part 2, 69% got it right. And the one that's underlined, 2018 question 9, that's just telling you it was a multiple choice question. So if you just want to do some multiple choice questions to get through some quick content, you can just go and do that. It's trying to structure the way you're doing your revision. The last exam, the last file I've given you, is I've gone and looked at every paper, 2022, the NHT papers back to 2017, and I've said, if you look at this, question number 1, which 80% of students got it right, I've covered that question in section 7, example 27. Okay, so if you do that paper and you get question 1 wrong, you go and have a look at an example, look at the theory, and you can find some other questions that are similar, are testing the same sort of idea. Okay, that's got you started. Now I'm going to talk about some content. Okay, this question here. I want to talk about the way you read questions, okay? And as I said, all the examples, everything that is going up on the screen has come out of the notes, so everything's there. Let's read this question. Cyclist pedals up a 15-degree slope at a constant speed. At that point, I stop when I'm reading the question and I think, what does constant speed mean to me? Acceleration 0, therefore net force is 0. Does that make sense? I think as I'm reading the question, I'm saying, where's the physics? The total mass of the rider in the bicycle is 100 kilogram. What's the magnitude of their net force? Oh, boring. I already know it's 0. So I've done my thinking before I actually read the question. That's the process I want you to do. The last thing is on the bottom of these slides, you'll see I've thrown little numbers down there. This concept of F net's equal to 0, the average mark over the previous study design was 46% of it, which is really quite disgusting. And it's been asked twice, and the average mark was 46%. I want you always to think in terms of F net's equal to MA. That's where we're starting from. I'm going to move to connected bodies. They come in a variety of guises. We can have them horizontal, we can have them vertical, we can have them pushing, pulling, or we can have them in two dimension. They're all the same. They all get solved the same way. Okay. Okay. All right, here's a ridiculous question. Anyone from the country will understand how stupid this question is. A tractor, including the driver, has a mass of 500 kilograms. It's towing a trailer of mass 2,000 kilograms. Let's unpack that. Let's put an 80-kilogram drive on my tractor, so I've got a 420-kilogram tractor. How big do you think a 420 kilogram tractor is? I'm going to say oversized ride on a lawnmower. Okay? It's pulling a trailer of mass 2,000 kilogram, two ton. I'm going to say double horse float with both horses in it. Okay? So I've got my ride on lawnmower pulling my double horse float with two horses in it. Yep, thanks, VCA. Good, I'm with you. I'm there. The tractor and the trailer are accelerating at 0.5 meters per second squared. Okay, all right. I've got a souped up ride on lawnmower that's going to be pulling my double horse float. Ignore the mass of the towing rope. Yes, VCAA, I'm going to connect the double horse float behind my souped up ride on lawnmower with a rope. And then I'm going to drive down a hill. Okay? Because I'm a thrill seeker. Good one, VCAA. You don't need to get too excited about it. Just let people like me tear shreds off them. Okay? That's what they do it for. All right. Let's look at a proper problem. Two masses are placed in contact on a rough surface. What's the word rough mean? It's telling me friction. If I don't want to have friction, what do I say? Smooth. Okay, fine. A force of 45 newton is acting on a 10-kilogram mass. The frictional force on the 10-kilogram mass is 10 newton, and the frictional force on the 20-kilogram mass is 20 newton. Good. What's the acceleration of the system with the two masses? I'm going to treat it as a system, and I'm going to click to the answer so we can all see what I'm talking about. We're going to start with F is equal to ma. We're going to say that the net force is going to be the 45 as it's acting minus the sum of all of the frictions that are acting, which is 30 newton, and that's going to give me a net force of 15 newton, and that's going to accelerate a mass of 30 kilogram, which gives me 0.5 meters per second squared. Straightforward. What is the force exerted by the 20-kilogram mass on the 10-kilogram mass while they're in motion? Okay, so I want to know the force of the 20 on the 10. I'm going to find that by finding the force of the 20 of the 10 on the 20 and then say it's equal and opposite. Does that make sense? That's the way I'm going to do that. So the force exerted by the 20-kilogram mass on the 10-kilogram mass is equal and opposite to the force of the 10 on the 20. Yep. And if the 20 is going at 0.5 metres per second, that means that the net force on it is going to be 10 newton. So what are the forces acting on it? I have got a 20 newton friction being acting on it, and so I have to end up with a net force of 10 newton, which means I need to apply a 30 newton push on it so that it's going to have a net force of 10 newton acting on it. That's the way I want you to think out these sorts of questions. They're actually not hard. All right. Don't do this at home. It's not actually action-reaction. Because action and reaction is the force of A on B is equal and opposite the force of B on A, and we didn't actually have the force of the hoof on the chest. The action and reaction pair was the force of the chest on the hoof. All right, let's get serious. Let's talk about a real problem. This is the sort of question which students struggle with. It's only been asked once on this current study design, but that means it doesn't mean that it's not going to come up this year. We've got two masses, and we're being asked to work out what the calculate the acceleration of M1 and calculate the magnitude of tension. With all of these questions, I have made some subtle changes so that the screen wasn't just absolutely full. I have edited the questions to get rid of so that the screen's not unbelievably crowded. Okay, what we do is we treat this as two parts, two problems, and we look at the mass that is going to have, that's going to move vertically to start off with. There are two forces acting on it. We can say there is a weight force down and a tension up. We know that it's going to move down, so we know that mg must be bigger than t because the net force has to be down. And so we can just put the numbers in and we can get that the weight down mg, m2g minus t is going to be equal to the mass M2 times its acceleration. You need to be a bit careful with this. Lots of kids have these on their cheat sheets, but it's random which one's going to be labelled M1 and which one's going to be labelled M2 each year. So you've just got to be a bit careful. We can rearrange that. So we can get an equation that says because the mass was 1, we can get 9.8 minus 2 is equal to the 1 times A, which is A. We then go and have a look at M1. The only force that's going to cause it to accelerate is the tension. Yes, I know it's got a weight, but the normal's cancelling that out. So I'm not interested in this vertical motion because it's not going to move in the vertical. I'm only interested in this horizontal. And that's going to give me that T is equal to 4A. The tension in both of those has to be the same because if you pull up one string, then it pulls back on you with the same force. And so we can rearrange that and get an acceleration of 2 meters per second squared. Once we know the acceleration is 2 meters per second squared, the question was, what is going to be the tension in the string? Well, that's the only force that's going to cause the 4 kilogram mass to accelerate. So it's just going to be 4 times 2, which is going to give you 8 newton. I want to move on to springs. Horizontal springs, most students can do fairly well. Vertical springs tend to sort students out. The first part of a vertical spring problem is typically going to be a force question. It's not an energy question, it's a force question. And you're going to be asked to solve the net force acting on the mass when it is stationary. So the net force is zero. So you're going to be asked to find what the weight force is and what the elastic force up is. So you're just going to equate K delta X is equal to mg, and you will solve that to find either K or M, depending on which one you're not given. Okay? There are K, delta X, M, and G. There are 4 variables. You're going to be given 3 of them and asked to find the fourth. Fairly simple. Then the process is the mass on the end of the spring is going to be set oscillating. And you're going to then work on from the principle that the total energy is going to be considered to be constant. And you're going to have to find out what the total energy is. The simplest spot to find out what the total energy is at the bottom. Because at the bottom, you know that it's not moving because it's at the bottom. So its kinetic energy is zero. And you can set its gravitational potential energy to be zero at that point too. Just measure everything from there. So now its total energy is just its spring energy, which is given by 1/2 k delta x squared, where delta x is how long the spring has been extended. Once you've got the total energy, you then just go back and find other points in the system. You might find where it's going fastest, what will be in the middle. That's fairly obvious because at the top it's not moving, at the bottom it's not moving. Where's it going fastest? Well, we'll guess in the middle. And so we just find that position there. Not too hard. So let's have a look at an example that's been asked 3 times and only 1/2 the state can do it. Spring has a spring constant of K is equal to 20 newtons per meter. A mass is hung. If the spring extends 0.6 meters to point R, calculate the mass. I don't think we can ask much simpler questions. F is equal to K delta X, where F is equal to mg, and so it's just a fairly simple substitution. It's a bit worrying that only 1/2 the state can do it. Okay? It's been asked 3 times in this current study design. It disturbs me that only 1/2 the state can get that right. The mass is raised to the point Q and released. It oscillates between Q and S. To change, calculate the change in spring potential energy as it's going from Q to S. Again, that's mgh. So it shouldn't actually be, sorry, I did that wrong. We don't know that. We don't know in this question that the better way to solve that was to actually work out what the extension was, and we can just go from there. Again, they're not difficult if you have a process for solving them, and that's what you've got to practice during your revision process. Let's move on to momentum. Block A is moving to the right at speed 8 metres per second. It collides with a stationary block B and rebounds to left. Its speed after the collision is 2 metres per second. Okay. So it rebounds. There's my big word in this question here. So it's rebounds. We have to know means it's going in the opposite direction. Calculate the speed of the block B after collision, and was the collision elastic? Support your conclusion by appropriate calculation. 71% could get it right the first time, 67% could get the second part right. It's straightforward. We're going to start off by saying momentum is conserved, therefore the initial momentum must be equal, or the final momentum must be equal to the initial momentum. And we can work out what the initial momentum is, make it equal, and it turns out to be 32, don't worry about the units. Assume that to the right is positive, and then that's going to mean that the final momentum of block A was actually negative, and then to find out what the final momentum is, we're going to say the initial momentum, 32, is 8 times V, that's what the velocity of the block B is, minus 4 times 2. Okay, only 43% of the state could get that, and my memory is that by and large the majority of the kids actually ended up with an answer that was, I think, 3 metres per second, because they didn't go 32 equals 8V minus 8, they actually had plus 8 in there, and then they ended up with 24 is equal to 8V, so therefore V is equal to 3. It was, I think, fairly deliberate from the markers to make the wrong answer a nice number too. Was the collision elastic? Back in 2008, we actually gave you 3 marks for this. Often this question's only worth 2 marks. And typically the first mark is for you to calculate the initial kinetic energy, and the second mark is for you to calculate the final kinetic energy and make the statement that the final is less than the initial, therefore the collision was inelastic. Just doing the two calculations, the initial kinetic energy is 128, the final kinetic energy is 108, collision is inelastic, that you're not going to get the third mark for making that statement, because you could have said 56 and 59 collisions is elastic or inelastic, whatever you want to say. You have to tell me why you're saying it, because otherwise you're just making a statement off your cheat sheet. Okay, sometimes we give you graphs. This graph, force distance graph, they were asking you for the work done. And they asked you for the work done in the first 500 metres, which typically means a count squared question. But, and I'll talk about counting squares later on, I'll come back to that. But this question was a bit sneaky, and sometimes the VCAR are sneaky. They're just trying, kids that think they can see that there's an intuitive way to solve this question. And it was the first 500 metres you wanted to do. What they expect you to do was to draw a line of best fit. If you did a line of best fit, the areas above and below the graph cancel each other out. All of a sudden, you're finding the area of a triangle, a half times the base times the height. Why the other kids are doing it methodically, and nothing wrong with methodical, but intuitive is sometimes really clever. If you do it in some of these questions, there's a really intuitive way of answering it. Okay. I want to move on to momentum and energy, and I want to play with them. We all know that momentum is equal to mv. No harm if I square the equation. So I've got p squared is equal to m squared v squared. No harm if I divide both sides by 2m. So p squared on 2m is equal to m squared v squared on 2m. Rearranging that gives me p squared on 2m is equal to mv squared on 2, which is the kinetic energy. Again, you don't need to write this down. Everything's in the notes. This is all of these things are done for you. And so that ends up giving me p squared on 2m is equal to the ke. No numbers involved, so it always works. Only one little condition I'll put on it. M has to be greater than zero. All right, so don't try using this for your photons. But as long as M is greater than zero, you can go with that. If I rearrange it, I can say that P squared is equal to 2mke, which gives me that P is equal to square root of 2mke. No problems. Simple, useful, powerful. Okay.
Projectile motion. This cart travels on an almost frictionless track. A trigger mechanism in the base of the cart can be used to release a compressed spring. As the spring expands, its restoring force can push a projectile up and out of the funnel of the cart. A heavy steel ball makes a good projectile for which air resistance is negligible. A metal clip halfway down the rail can be used to activate the trigger mechanism on the cart. Once it leaves the spring, the only force acting on the ball is the vertical force of gravity. In the laboratory frame of reference, a projectile ejected from the cart moving in a constant horizontal velocity will travel in a parabolic path under the influence of the vertical gravitational force. If we observe this event in the frame of reference of the cart, by moving the camera at the same velocity as the cart, the projectile has no horizontal velocity component. In this frame of reference, the projectile moves only vertically under the influence of gravity.
Okay, I like that one because it sorts out and solves how we can look at things from different frames of reference, which surprisingly I'll come back to in relativity. Okay, the next one has limited educational value. Just don't do it at home. This one. Clearly, their teacher had always told them to ignore the effects of air resistance. Okay, sometimes you don't. This one, it'd be a cheap shot if I had a Qantas joke just to abuse them. But seeing they cancelled my flight this at 10:20 last night to go home this afternoon, I'm going to. This is Qantas landing. That's what I think of Qantas. Okay. When we're doing projectile motion, I encourage you to divide it into two motions. Consider the horizontal motion where the velocity is always constant, because the acceleration is, we're ignoring air resistance, is equal to zero. And so the displacement in the x direction is just the horizontal velocity times time. In the vertical direction, we've got acceleration. So we're just going to have an accelerated motion there, and our position, our displacement is going to be y is equal to ut minus a half gt squared. To find the velocity at any point, you use vectors. I haven't told you how much I like vectors, but you will get the point later on of how much I like vectors. And if the flight is symmetrical, you can actually use the range formula. I discourage kids using the range formula, but students like it, I don't. And it only works if the flight is symmetrical and there is no air resistance. If we look at the sorts of questions which they ask, they're going to ask things like calculate the maximum height here. What do we know is happening at the maximum height? That the vertical velocity is zero. So we're just going to solve it for the vertical velocity is equal to zero. That's fairly straightforward. I'm skipping because the time is getting away from me here. We might be asked to find out what the distance d is. Now, if we just substitute into y is equal to ut minus a half gt squared, we're going to get an answer, and we do the substitution and we actually find that the answer is minus 22.5. That's okay. That just means that it is below where it took off. That's all you've got to consider. How do we know what time it is in that for it to get to there? We know it's going to travel 173 meters, so we use the horizontal velocity to find the time it takes to travel horizontally 173 metres, and then that's the time which we're then finding its actual vertical position. Time is the link between the horizontal and the vertical. All right. Circular motion. Car's travelling around a horizontal path in a circular curve. The car's speed is constant and it's travelling from left to right. Which of the following diagrams best shows horizontal forces, solid lines, and the resultant force? We should know from circular motion that the net force is radially inwards. So therefore, if we're looking at this question, we're going to say, it has to be either A or E. I've done the hard work for you. What I'd like to do is hands up those. The answer is either A or E. Hands up those who think the answer is A. Hands up those who think the answer is E. Hands up those who don't think. Yeah. Okay, fine. Clear. If the answer was A, and I said I like vectors, if the answer was A, is there any way I can have that vector and get a vector going straight down? The answer is no. So the answer has to be E, where I add the two vectors together. I like vectors. They're on the exam constantly. If we're talking about vertical circles, which I'm going to talk about, you can actually identify what's going up at the top. We've got something going around in a vertical circle in at a constant speed, so we know the net force is constant. At the top, the two forces are the normal force and the weight force. They're acting in the same direction. They add up to give me F net. Down the bottom, we know the normal force needs to be greater because it's acting in the opposite direction. We're going to just say that F net is going to be n plus or minus mg, depending on what it is, and that's going to equal mv squared on r. Okay. What I've done in the next one is Einstein helped me. I attached him to a spring, and then I swung him around in a circle. What I'm trying to do is for you to visualise, and it's a bit hard to see, but I'm going to get you to try and visualise what the length of the normal force is, which is the force that I'm applying to Einstein, which is actually measured by the length of the spring. Okay, does that make sense? So what I'm trying to show you is that as it goes around, can you sort of see that the circle at the top is reasonable, but the circle at the bottom is unreasonable, so the tension, the force that I need to apply via the spring at the bottom is much larger, okay? That's what I'm trying to show you. Here is another stupid VCAR question. I could lecture for hours just on these stupidities. Okay. A demonstration at a show involves a bike being ridden around a circular bank track. The horizontal path the bike takes is a radius of 20 metres and the bike travels at a constant speed of 15 metres per second. Reasonable speed, that's 54 kilometres an hour, if anyone is interested. The bike and the rider have a total mass of 300 kilograms. Yep. Good one, thanks. I wrote to VCAR and I said, look, I think you missed a question, you missed a diagram out on this question. You actually should have put that in because now my students can understand what a 300-kilogram cyclist would look like. With bank curves, sorry, time is really getting away from me. Because you're laughing too long. It's your fault, not mine. With a banked curve, they look like inclined planes, but they're different because in an inclined plane, the net force is down the slope. With a banked curve, the net force is radially inwards. We sometimes get you to draw those forces. I've had students try and draw them and not sure, does it go horizontal or does it go down the plane? Why don't I draw something in between the two of them and let the examiner decide whether that is actually horizontal or down the plane? No, you're wrong. It has to be clearly horizontal or clearly down the plane. Conical pendulum is exactly the same as a banked curve because this time we're going to resolve the tension and we can say that mg is equal to t cos theta and t sine theta is the net force acting radially inwards and that's going to equal mv squared over r. fairly straightforward. Here's another pendulum. This is one of my Unite. Don't do this at home. You tell them not to push the bowling ball just before you do it. Okay, this is the sort of question we're going to ask you. Sometimes we ask you to draw and label the forces. So this is what I want you to do. It's funny, the question says, draw the forces acting on the car using solid lines and label each of the force. Show the resultant forces of dotted line labelled FR. The only forces acting on this are going to be the normal force and the weight force. FN, FG, I think is perfectly appropriate. You might want to write them as normal and weight. It doesn't really matter. I think when you're drawing them, though, and I always prefer my normal forces to come from a surface, their contact forces, so they come from the surface, and the weight force should come from the center of mass. And I always think the net force acts through the center of mass. When you're drawing the vectors, they should actually look like they're right. If your net force was about 10 times longer in the right direction, I sort of be wondering, do you understand what's going on here? Okay. I'm going to keep going. No. I'm going to stop. You can think about this one. We're going to start. You got 5 minutes, okay? Sorry, guys. You laughed too long. I have to stop and wait, so it's your problem. Please, if you need the toilet, make a mad dash. If you need a drink, like me, grab one. If you want to just sit there and chat to the person next to you, please do so.
Oh, great. I wonder whether they're about to bring them back into the lecture theatre, though. I suppose if they drink, they just water out of it?
Yes, water, there's juice.
Just worried if they all go now, Wendy, that they won't get back in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe I should.
Hello.
It looks like the drinks might be for lunch.
Yeah, so
that's
what I thought. Hello. I was supposed to get an email of the...
Yeah, what's your name?
Jada. Yeah.
Sorry, by default 80%, I put it to about 90%, I think. I don't know how loud it goes.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so I can put to 100 if you want.
Well, you probably might be a bit distorted. So.
Yeah.
No, that's it. Well done, everyone, for taking such a quick break. Very impressive. So we're back for round two. We've covered motion, and now we're heading forwards into
relatively speaking, and then we'll field a few ideas, okay?
Relativity and fields. So over to you, Colin.
Thank you. Okay. Einstein, first thing we need to understand is Einstein's two postulates. So, his first postulate is that all the laws of physics are the same in all inertial frames. We have only ever tested that by asking you to identify what an inertial frame is. So we really, the way the exam questions have been, they've just said, identify which frame is the inertial frame. The next idea, the next one of his postulates, is that the speed of light is the same in all inertial frames. So it's the same regardless of the motion of the source of the light. I would have thought that that one was a fairly straightforward idea, but if you have a look at this one's been asked once on the current study design, and when it was asked, and it has been asked in the past, the average mark's been 40%. And I would have thought this was a gimme mark. Okay, the question is, we've got the spaceship Andromeda, who's travelling at 0.7C towards the asteroid Ceres. It sends a light pulse to a nearby ship, Bradbury B, which is approaching the asteroid from the far side of 0.8C. So there's a whole lot of information that's really irrelevant. And then it says the speed of the light pulse as measured from each body is, well, the speed of the light pulse is the same. It's C. So the answer should just be D. Only 40% of the state can do it. I think they're easy marks, okay? It shows a little bit how students can get rattled on the exam, okay? So I might actually digress from my notes and talk a little bit about that. Some students, When you're doing the exam, I would always suggest that you start doing the multiple choice questions. You do them all. You don't leave any of them blank. Do them all. And then you get stuck into section B. When you're doing section B, I think you should do the questions you know how to do first. So if you don't know how to do a question or if you always struggle with it, leave it. Come back to it later on, okay? Because the last thing you want to do is to run out of time before you've run out of knowledge, okay? The reality is that on the exam, 99% of students, 99.9% of students run out of knowledge before they run out of time, okay? So, you know, so just if you get if you start getting rattled by trying to do questions you don't know how to do, you lose confidence, and the ones that you can do, you don't tackle as well. So when you're doing section B, I'd be doing the questions you like doing first. Just leave the others out, then come back to them. Okay. Proper time and proper length. The proper time is the time that's measured in the reference frame when the clock is stationary. So the observer and the clock are relatively stationary. So proper time is measured by one clock. If it requires more than one clock in more than one position, then it can't be proper time. It has to be the dilated time, okay? Or we're actually measuring the time interval, but I'm just using the word time. The proper length is the measured length in the frame where the object is stationary or the distance between the two events is stationary. So proper length and proper time are measured in different frames of reference, and the proper time is measured in the moving frame and the proper length is measured in the stationary frame. For me, it's all about frames of reference. You find the stationary frame and then you work from there, you know. Okay, time dilation. So we know that the time, the proper time is always going to be the dilated time is always going to be longer than the proper time because we've got to multiply by gamma. We know that gamma is going to be more one greater than or equal to one. We know that the length is going to be contracted. The proper length is going to be contracted because it's divided by gamma. I suggest on your cheat sheet that you put a table of values for gamma. And you're not trying to guess the value of gamma that the question's going to be asked. But when you're doing that calculation, gamma is 1 over square root 1 minus v squared over c squared, you are hoping that your calculator gives you the correct answer and that you put in the right information. So if I gave you, if you knew that gamma was equal to 2.5, and then you had to do a calculation to find out what the percent, what fraction of C the speed was. Gamma was 2.5. What is the value for V as a fraction of C? If you know it's 2.5, you know your answer when you've done your calculation needs to be greater than 0.866, but less than 0.980. Does that make sense to you? It's got to be in that gap. So if you do the calculation and your answer is in the right gap, then your answer will be right, because if you've stuffed up the calculation, you're going to stuff it up majorly. You're not going to muck up the third decimal place. You're going to muck up the first decimal place, okay? So you have a table of values so that it's just a security blanket for when you do a calculation and you're just going to check to see, yes, that makes sense. I've put the right data in. Your calculator will give you the right answer if you put the right data in. Next question. Spacecraft S-66 is travelling at high speed away from Earth, carrying a highly accurate atomic clock. Another spacecraft, T-50, is travelling in the opposite direction. Which of the following observers will be able to measure the proper time using this clock? Well, we know the proper time can be only measured by the person that is stationary relative to the clock. So the clock is in S-66. So anyone in S-66 will measure the proper time. So the answer was A. Again, that idea has been asked 5 times and the average mark is only 50% of the time kids can get that right. I think you've just got to just think about what's going on, not get too fussed. Okay, a comet chasing spacecraft CCS2 travels at the speed for which gamma is 1.5 relative to the nearest stars. It approaches comet 203, which is effectively stationary relative to the nearest stars. There is a landing probe attached to CCS2. The designated landing area on the comet is a length of 500 metres, and the comet's frame is parallel to the spacecraft. There's a lot of language in these questions. I would recommend that you spend some time getting your head straight when you're doing it during reading time, okay? But what we're saying here is that the 500 metres, which is measured in the comet's frame, that is your... That is the proper length, okay? And now we've asked, what is the length of this landing area as measured by instruments on CCS2? Well, so the spacecraft is moving. So it's moving relative to the length it's trying to measure. So it is going to measure the contracted length, okay? That's all we need to understand there. And you're given, you know, your answer is going to be either multiply by gamma or divide by gamma, okay? Then you think about, is it going to be longer or shorter? And then get gamma to do the arithmetic for you, okay? It is not that complicated. Okay, the next question relating to that one, spacecraft CCS2 releases a probe that will land on the comet. Near touchdown, the probe is at the same velocity as the comet. Which of the following is able to measure the proper length of the landing area? Well, it's going, because it's going at the same velocity, its velocity relative to the landing area is zero. So it's stationary. So it is going to be able to measure the observer there. So that's what we're looking for there. That question was actually done well. 82% of kids could do this. What about muons? Muons cause a lot of grief. And I've steered away from the standard question because hopefully you've worked that through. A space lab travelling at U is equal to 0.8C, which gamma is 1.67, away from Earth, can record high-energy particles passing through its detectors. One particle is travelling towards Earth at 0.91C relative to the space lab. Okay, we needed to know that. Two detectors numbered 1 and 2 are 2 metres apart in the space lab's frame. How far apart are the two detectors in this particular particle's frame? Well, they're moving. The proper length is the distance that's measured between the detectors is given by 2 meters. Sorry, between the two detectors is 2 meters. In the particle's frame, it's in relative motion, so it's going to measure the contracted length. So we just divide by 2.4. Again, it's not difficult. What about our ideas with energy? A pion and its antiparticle, each at rest, annihilate to produce 2 photons whose total energy is 4.5 by 10 to the minus 11 joule. Apart from the 2 photons, nothing else is produced in this process. The masses of the pions and the antiparticle are the same. The rest mass of the pion must be, we're just going to use E is equal to mc squared or delta mc squared so that the mass is converted to other forms. Again, it's just an arithmetic process. Lots of students have on their cheat sheet that c squared is equal to 9 by 10 to the 16. The biggest problem students have with this sort of question is not understanding it. It's more doing the number crunching and they forget to square something somewhere. That's the biggest problem. This one, you also had to understand that there were 2 masses, so you worked out what M was, and then you realised you had the pion and the antipion, so you had to actually divide it by 2. I want to move on to fields now. You need to be able to draw field lines for electric fields, gravitational fields, and magnetic fields. We need to understand how to draw them. There are a few simple rules, the first 3, which we pay attention when we're marking, the last one we don't. Field lines do not touch across each other. So when you're drawing them, take care. If you touch or cross, you've just thrown a mark away. How many of you can afford to just throw marks away like that? Not many. The arrows showed the direction of the field, and the further the field lines were apart, the weaker the field. So we're expecting to see a difference in the strength of the field to be recognised by the field lines that are further apart. And the last one, field lines start and end perpendicular to the surface. No, we don't pay attention to that. It's too hard. We need to understand how to draw the field lines around for electric fields, around point charges, and for uniform fields. Okay? We need to understand that the direction of the electric field is the direction of the force on a small positive charge. So if you put a small positive charge there, in which direction is it going to experience a force? That's the field. Here's a question with just point charges in it. And again, there's some of the questions, there's a fair bit of language in them. Two equal point charges are placed at the points K and L. K is up on the left and L's down the bottom. Produce a resultant field at the point X with a magnitude of 100 volts per meter in the direction of T. So that's what we would expect. The charge at point K is then shifted halfway towards X, so it's moved to point M, which of the arrows is going to best describe the resultant field. We know the field's going to vary as 1 on K, Q1, Q2 on R squared. So if we make this distance smaller, the field's going to get stronger. So we're actually expecting the field from M to be larger than it is from L, and so it is going to give us a resultant like that. As I said, I love vectors, okay? You're going to use them all the time. Next question, next idea. A helium nucleus contains two protons and two neutrons. The protons P1 and P2, each with a charge of 1.6 by 10 to minus 19, are separated by 1.4 by 10 to minus 15 metres, and the electrostatic force is 118 newton. Fine, lots of information. What is the magnitude of electric static force between the neutron N1 and the proton P1? Unfortunately, a lot of students went and tried to go F is equal to K, Q1, Q2 on R squared. Failing to recognise the charge on the neutron is zero. So Q2 became zero, and all of a sudden my answer was just zero. There are some times when you need to really be careful and think about what you're doing when you're answering the question. You also need to understand uniform electric fields. We create a uniform electric field when we have two plates, two parallel plates. We don't worry about the bits at the ends there because the vector addition doesn't give us a uniform field, but we won't. We'll talk about vectors. This question, fairly simple. Electrons accelerated from rest between two parallel charge plates in a vacuum with a potential difference of 100 volts. The plates are separated by the distance of 0.02 metres. Calculate the electric field. And the key to this question is the bit that I just didn't read, and it says in volts per metre. They've told you what to do. The answer has to be volts divided by metres. So what do? You get the 100 volts. You divide it by 0.02 metres and you write that answer. Sometimes the answer box on the exam will give you information if you're uncertain what to do. Be strategic, be comfortable looking at it. All you had to do is, if you knew E was equal to V on D, not a problem. But if you didn't know that or if you've forgotten it, have a look at the units and use them to help you get through. Sometimes you can work backwards and use the answers in the units in the answer box to tell you what to do. In the electron gun of a synchrotron, electrons are accelerated from rest over a distance of 12 centimetres to reach a final speed of 8 by 10 to the 7 metres per second. What is the accelerating voltage of the electron gun in kilovolts? We need to understand, and the formula sheet tells us, that the work done is equal to QV, and it's so we can identify that the kinetic energy is going to be the work done on it is this change in kinetic energy. And so we work out what the work done on it is by finding its kinetic energy, and that must be equal to QV. So we're trying to equate two formulas together, two equations together, to actually come up with a relatively simple answer. And again, I thought that was fairly straightforward. The cheat sheet, the official formula sheet does actually give you that the half MV squared is equal to QV. So you're never going to get a mark on the exam for making that statement. And you really just had to substitute the numbers in, and then you got one mark for the correct answer, basically. Okay. Gravitational motion. What we're going to do here is we're going to model all of our gravitational motion as circular motion. It's not correct, but it's a nice model. So we're going to say that the acceleration is going to be V squared on R, because that's what we got from our circular motion. We're going to say that the velocity is 2 pi R over T, it's circumference divided by time, which is going to give me the acceleration is 4 pi squared R over T squared. Okay. We're also then going to link that F is equal to GMM over R squared and that F is equal to MG. You may notice that I will always write the gravitational force as F is equal to G big M little m over R squared. I recommend that. I don't like M1, M2. I prefer big M little m, because big M is the mass of the central body. It's the mass of the body that the other one is orbiting around. Remind yourself every time which one is the central body by writing big M, little m. You can equate G is equal to GM on R squared and A is equal to 4 pi squared R over T squared and get Kepler's law, which we use as GM on 4 pi squared is equal to R cubed over T squared. It's not part of the course. It's not on the cheat sheet. It should be on your cheat sheet, because you need it. We use it constantly. And you need to be careful that you know how to use it. What do we know? Why do we use it? Because G is constant for everything orbiting the same central body. Big M is constant and 4 pi squared is constant. So the ratio of R cubed over T squared is actually a constant for everything orbiting the same central body. Here's a question I'm going to ask you, because you've no idea what the answer is. And this is what you get confronted with basically every time you do a gravitational question, that the numbers you're dealing with are so large that you have no idea whether your answer is right, and you are totally dependent on your calculator to do it. So my question is, what's the force of attraction between the sun and the earth? Okay. And I've given you four options. You've got no idea what the answer is, basically, I would assume. I had no idea when I first started looking at it, so I don't expect you to have any idea. But we use the formulas and we do it. There are two ways of making these sorts of substitutions. We're going to go with F is equal to GMM over R squared, and I've given you the values for G, M, M, and R. The first way, which is the common way that people will do it, is they'll go 6.7 by 10 to the minus 11 times 2 by 10 to the 30 by 6 by 10 to the 24 divided by 1.5 by 10 to the 11 all squared. And they do that on the calculator. A lot of students get lost in that process. What I recommend you do is, instead of doing it just as it comes out, is you rearrange the equation and put all the numbers first and then put all the powers to the side. And so that you do the number part first. So you're going to go 6.7 times 2 times 6 divided by 1.5 divided by 1.5. And you get that answer. And then you do the power part of the problem by just dealing with the indices and using your index laws. Does that process make sense? Because when you do it, if you're going 6.7 times 2 times 6 and you come up with 80.4, you know that that's right, because it makes sense to you, because you've got an image in your head of what 6 times 2 times 6 is going to look like. Okay, so your brain says, yeah, that makes sense. But if you're just doing all of the numbers, you're just hoping that the answer, you put the right data in. The answer will be correct according to what you put in. It's whether you put the right data in. A couple of years ago, we asked this question. It was done abysmally. Okay, 17% of the state could get this. And the question was, the radius of the Earth is that. Assume the Earth is a sphere of constant density. A graph of gravitational field strength versus distance from the centre of the Earth is shown. Explain why the gravitational field strength is zero at the centre of the Earth. A lot of students wanted to tell us that R was equal to zero, so F is equal to, G is equal to GM on R squared, R is equal to zero, gave me zero. I always thought dividing by zero gave me an undetermined number, but anyway, others seem to think it was zero. They got zero for that question, what they deserve. The real answer is that if we consider little columns of mass on top of or surrounding the bit in the middle, there are forces in all directions pulling on that mass in the middle. And so the net force on it has to be zero. Does that idea make sense? That it's surrounded in three dimensions by mass, and the rest of that mass is actually attracting it up towards, yeah, in their direction. So if we have a look at the vectors of this, we'll end up with the vector equation, the vector sum of it is zero. Okay, that's the way I want you to be thinking about this sort of question. All right, I was asked before about counting squares, and I said I was going to do a question on the gravitational force on a 700 kilogram Mars Odyssey spacecraft is plotted. Estimate the minimum launch energy required. Okay. We got a gut idea that this is going to be, this is a force distance graph. We need to find the area under the graph because that's the work done. Okay. And that's how much energy we need. The VCAA have a simple rule about counting squares when we're marking. If it's a half or more, it counts as one. And that's the end of the rule. If it's a half or more, it counts as one. So all the little bits, ignore them. Okay? You don't need to do anything. A half or more counts as one. If I looked at this, I would say that all of those squares were a half or more. So I'll count them as one. I count it as 12. When you're doing this, show me you're working out. Yeah, give me some indication of what you're doing. And then I'm just saying there's about 12 squares and we'll do that. We will always give you a range of values on the answer. You don't have to agree with me. You just have to be close. You need to show me what you're doing. Magnetic fields. We identify the direction of the field by identifying the direction of the force that's acting on an impossible north monopole. You cannot get monopoles, all magnets are dipoles, but we put a pretend north monopole there and we find the direction of the force that that would experience a force. That's what you do. This question here, two identical bar magnets of the same strength, that always worries me. They're identical and they have the same strength. I would have thought that we'd already said they were identical, but anyway, why don't we say two identical bar magnets with the identical strength are arranged at right angles and equidistant from the point P. At point P on the diagram, draw an arrow indicating the direction of the combined magnetic field of the bar magnets. All right, straightforward. The field from the north pole that is horizontal is going to go to the right. The field from the south pole that is vertical is going to go down. So we're going to add the two of them together and get a vector in that direction. It should look like 45 degrees. Okay? It should look like 45 degrees. The question said, I also think you need to, the question said, at point P on the diagram, I think that means your vector should touch the point P, because some people might think that's an appropriate answer. And that's close to P, but if that's correct, is that correct? And if that's correct, is that one correct? And I would say no to all those last three. I would say if it says a point P, touch the point P. Okay, right-hand rules. Hands up those who have been taught left-hand rules. Okay, so we've got some being taught left-hand rules. Students get taught right-hand rules and left-hand rules. Perfectly valid. I always only taught my kids right-hand rules, only because they're the ones I got taught. When you're using a right-hand rule, specify it. Don't think that I know what you're talking about. Don't talk about the right-hand rule. Is it the right-hand force rule or is it the right-hand grip rule? Okay, which if you're just saying right-hand rule, yeah, fine. I don't know what you're talking about. You need to be specific. I would also suggest, as I said earlier on, 99.9% of you are going to run out of knowledge before you run out of time. So specify with the current in the direction of my thumb, the field in the direction of my fingers, and the force is perpendicular to my hand. Be ultra specific.
Electron beam deflection by a magnet. An electron beam passes through the horizontal slit and hits the angled screen. The resultant strip of green fluorescent light shows that the electron beam travels in a straight line. When the north pole of a magnet is brought in horizontally towards the glass tube, a vertical magnetic force exists which is perpendicular to both the horizontal magnetic field and the electron beam. This magnetic force deflects the electron beam upwards. As the magnet gets closer to the glass tube, the strength of the magnetic field increases, as does the resultant magnetic force. This means that the electron beam is deflected more strongly. If the south pole of a magnet is brought in horizontally, the resultant magnetic force is still vertical but now points down rather than up. The electron beam is now deflected downwards.
And I unknowingly to Swinburne thank them very much for supplying me with these videos about 25 years ago. Not to their knowledge. Anyway, we're going to use BQV is equal to MV squared over R because my idea of circular motion is when the force acting on it is at right angles to the velocity. So if I have a constant force acting at right angles to the velocity, the thing is going to move in a circle. I wanted to show you that video because I wanted you to understand that the force is on the electrons. The force is on the current. When you're talking about motors later on, if you tell me the force is on the wire, I'm not going to give you a mark because the force isn't on the wire. I can get a copper wire here, bring a magnet next to it, and there is no force on it. The force is on the current in the wire, and that's the point I'm trying to make. This question. An electron leaves an electron gun traveling at 2.7 by 10 to 7 meters per second. The electron enters a uniform electric field and moves in a circle, the circular path of radius 14 centimeters. Which of the following best describes the direction of the magnetic field? Okay, there's a little bit of trickery with the arithmetic if we were dealing with that question, but I'm not going to. What you need to do is the electron. At the top, the electron is moving to the right, so the current is to the left. So my thumb goes to the left, the force is down. So when I've got my thumb for my left, pointing to my left, I'm sorry, I'll do it like that. When my thumb is pointing to the left and the force is down, my fingers, which are the field, have to be pointing into the page. That's all you need to do. When you're doing this, I really recommend that you spend the time and twist your arm around to get it right. Don't get fussed. The invigilators are not going to get fussed by you waving your arm around. They're accustomed to physics students doing unusual things, okay? That's, you know, and you've chosen that by doing physics. All right.
DC Motor. A square coil of wire attached to an axle is placed between the poles of the magnets. The coil is connected to a DC voltage and current flows through it. The magnetic field exerts a force on the current-carrying wires of the coil, causing it to turn on the axle. The commutator connecting the rotary coil to the voltage supply changes the direction of the current through the coil every half turn, while ensuring that the force from the magnetic field always rotates the coil in the same direction.
Okay, I don't know whether you've been and looked at Walter Fenn's applets for how a DC motor works. If you haven't, the link is in the notes. You should go and have a look at it. And then when they're asking you to describe how a DC motor works, get this picture in your head and then visualize what it's doing and then tell me the story about what you're seeing in your head. Don't try remembering it. Remember the picture and then describe what you're seeing. Far more powerful way of doing it. Okay. This question here. Straightforward. Students build a simple electric motor consisting of a single coil and a magnetic field is whatever, whatever. Calculate the magnitude of the force on side WX. Okay, fairly straightforward. It's been asked four times and basically about 80% of the students get it right. It's a fairly simple question. F is equal to Bill, and we're just going to go and crunch some numbers in. Make sure you get all your units right and it's not a problem. The next question is, will the coil rotate in a clockwise or anti-clockwise direction as seen by the observer at the split ring commutator? Explain your answer. This one shouldn't have been too difficult because we can have a look at the current. The current is going from W to X. The field is going from north to south. So if I do that, I can then find that it is going to rotate in an anti-clockwise direction when I'm looking at it from the front. Whenever my kids were doing a SAC, they always got a question that looked like this so that I could laugh at them, okay? And I always made the current, I always made it, and I can't do this, I'll just do it in my direction, my orientation. The field's going in that direction. The current's going in that direction, so you've got to twist your arm around like that to find the forces up. I always used to make my kids contort because here is the question in the paper here. If you're having to contort, take a risk and turn the page around and then your hand goes really easily and shows you the direction of the force. So feel comfortable if the question's making you do something like that to actually literally pick the page up and turn it around and make your life easy. Explain the role of the split ring commutator in the operation of the electric motor. This answer is, I think, it's a fairly standard question and it's one which you should possibly have on your cheat sheet so that you can do it. For me, the role of the commutator is to reverse the direction of the current every half cycle or every half turn so that the direction of the force on, and here's my key word, the current carrying wire, if you don't tell me it's a current carrying wire, I've just thrown a mark away, is reversed every half turn in order to keep the motor rotating in the same direction. For me, that's three marks. That's two or three marks easy. You might want to say that the direction of the current reverses when the coil is at right angles to the field, that's insurance. Okay, here's a very simple motor, stolen off the internet, and everything on the internet, you know, looks really simple and takes probably 1,000 hours to get to that point. But anyway, here's a very simple motor. Got a magnet, got a current source, got a coil, got a motor. Okay, sweet. But not something you'll ever do unless you've got half a life you want to waste. Okay. I want to move on to flux and induced EMF. Lots of the questions will talk about, the old questions will talk about Faraday's law and Lenz's law. They're not on the study design. I think you should understand them, okay? And you should understand that Faraday's law is going to give us the induced EMF is minus N times the rate of change of flux, and that Lenz's law is going to give us the direction that that the current or the EMF is going to be.
Faraday's law. Whenever the magnetic flux threading a loop of wire is changing, an EMF is induced in the loop. This EMF, which is proportional to the rate of change of the magnetic flux, generates a current in the wire. The direction of current flow is such that the magnetic field associated with this current opposes the change in the original magnetic flux. This phenomena is known as Faraday's law. When the magnet moves away from the loop, the magnetic flux threading the loop decreases, a current flows, and the needle moves to the right. When the magnet stops, there is no change in the magnetic flux and the current returns to zero. When the magnet moves towards the loop, the magnetic flux increases, the current now flows in the opposite direction, and the needle moves to the left. Another way of inducing an EMF in a loop of wire is to move the loop into or out of a region of constant magnetic field. This also increases or decreases the magnetic flux through the loop and therefore generates a current. The direction of the induced current depends upon the direction of the field and whether the magnetic flux is increasing or decreasing.
Okay. There are, for me, four fairly simple steps to answering all flux questions. First step, identify the direction of the initial flux. It's going to the left, right, up, down. Simple. Then identify or indicate how is it changing. Is the flux increasing or decreasing? So set the scene. The initial flux was down and it's increasing. Okay, you set the scene. Then you come in and make a statement along the lines of saying that the induced EMF by this change in flux, will induce an EMF which will create a current. The current will have a field associated with it which is going to oppose the change in the flux. So you've got to have that understanding. So you identify what the initial flux is, in its direction, and then you identify whether it's increasing or decreasing. Then you identify the fact that the induced EMF is going to have a current, create a current that will oppose this change. Now you apply that to the scenario that you've got in front of you. That's your process, okay? They're fairly simple steps, and I think that if you can do that, you will do well in answering this type of question. They're not done well. 35% is the average mark. It's been asked 8 times out of the last 10 papers. A square loop inside 10 centimetres is allowed to move horizontally through a region of a uniform magnetic field. Determine whether the current will flow from X to Y or from Y to X through the metre A as the loop moves into the magnetic field. Explain your answer. Okay, which direction is the initial flux? The field is down. So the flux from when we have an area is going to be down. As the loop comes in, the flux is down and is increasing. Okay, yep, does that make sense? That's my first two steps. Now, what am I going to do? I'm going to induce an EMF because the flux is changing and the current from that EMF is going to create a field to oppose the flux down that's increasing. So the current needs to be going up to oppose, the field from the current needs to be going up. So my current needs to be going from the front of the loop to the back of the loop on the leading edge. That's your thinking. So it says the initial flux through the loop is downwards and increasing. Lenz's law gives that the induced current will produce a field that will create an increasing upwards flux to oppose the change in flux. Use the right-hand grip rule to determine that the current will flow anti-clockwise through the loop and to reduce the field upwards and hence from X to Y through the meter A. If you follow that logic, you should be able to do that. That was worth 4 marks, but it was the average mark for that sort of question is very poor.
Electricity generator. A square coil of wire attached to an axle is placed between the poles of some magnets. As the axle is turned, the magnetic flux through the coil changes. The changing magnetic flux induces an EMF in the coil. If the coil is part of a circuit, then the induced EMF will cause an electric current to flow as indicated on the galvanometer.
Okay. The next type of idea which I want to talk about is what is the difference between the split ring commutator and slip rings? Okay. So the question's asking, explain the difference in function of slip ring commutator and slip rings. Describe the situations in which a split ring commutator and slip rings are used. Okay. Again, it's been asked 4 times. And the average mark's been 50% for this. What we need to be able to do is to say that slip rings, when we've got slip rings, each ring stays connected to either P or Q throughout the cycle. This produces an AC output. The split ring swaps the connection from P to Q and Q twice every cycle, and it will reverse the direction of the current every half cycle. So slip rings are used to produce AC, while split ring will produce a DC output. That's all that you're required to be able to do. Okay. All right, peak to peak, peak and RMS. I find these incredibly easy, but students seem to struggle a little bit with them. I have this picture in my mind, so that's why it's easy. You may have noticed I'm a fairly visual teacher and I'm a visual learner. You know, I carry pictures around. I don't remember things. In fact, I have no memory, but I have pictures that I store in my head. If you've got this picture in your head, clearly the peak to peak is going to go from the top to the bottom. So it's going to be the biggest. The peak is going to go half of the peak to peak. And the RMS, well, that's the average. The average value has to be smaller than the peak value. How much smaller? Root 2. I don't find this stuff at all difficult, okay? I just think that if you've got this picture, you're under control, okay? Transformers. First thing we need to do when we come across a transformer question is to check the input. Is it DC? Or is it AC? That is the first thing you do with every transformer question. That is the skill that you practice during your revision. This one's AC, fine. Then it's talking about calculate the RMS voltage across the resistor. Easy stuff. We know that the ratio of the primary to the secondary voltage is going to be the same as the ratio of the primary to secondary number of turns. And so the ratio, if we think back to that, the ratio is 1 to 6. And so the voltage is going to be 6 times as great. Okay, this is simple arithmetic. Transmission line problems. There's a strategy which I think you should use, which can apply to most transmission line problems, okay? You will either be supplied with the input voltage or you're asked to find the output voltage, or you'll be given the output voltage and asked to find the input voltage. That's the basic scenario. Once you know what you're trying to find, then we have a process for doing it. The first step is to find what the current through the transmission lines is. Okay, and the current through the transmission lines is going to lead to a voltage drop. or a potential difference across the transmission lines. That's what we're looking for. Then you're going to find that you're losing a lot of power because there's a lot of current going through your transmission lines. So the next step is we'll put some transformers in, and we'll put a pair of transformers in, and we'll step the voltage up, which steps the current down. If we step the current down, then our power losses given by I squared R, where R is the resistance of the transmission lines, is going to go down. If we step them down, then we don't lose so much energy in the transmission, so we end up with more energy at the output end. And then we step the voltage back down because none of us want 10,000 volts at the other side of our power point because we're a little bit scared by that, rightly so. Okay. It is almost 10:02, so I'm actually going to stop. I'm going to leave you with one little last thought. If you can just have a quick read through that. And I need to say, don't feel under pressure if you don't get it. For those of you, I did mean to say at the start that I was actually going to deliberately do what I thought were a couple of funny things. If you've thought them funny, I think that actually is a fairly sad comment on the state of your mind if your humour is the same as mine. So I think that makes you a bit of a worry. Okay, it is 10:02. I have finished on time for once. It's now lunchtime. Barbara?
All right, well done, everyone, for being such an attentive audience. Those of you who'd like to go to the Astro Tour, the 12 o'clock Astro Tour, you need to go and get over to that now. The rest of you, enjoy your campus tour and or lunch. See you back at 1 o'clock.
And I'm incredibly happy to answer questions. If you've got any questions, just ask.
Any questions, please come to the front. Colin's still on duty. Okay.
I'll get you guys. So Barbara is typing an answer. And I realise Dan's Barbara and Barbara's Dan.
Yeah. I'm just wondering how many fractions is your 400s?
That's how long is this script?
Yeah.
I wonder how many.
I'm Shannon.
Hi, Shannon.
How are you? Sure. Yes.
Nice to meet you. Yeah. It's a useful day for your guys.
Yeah. And so if you can get every question.
That's good. You hit yourself in the headspace, actually, of the student who's sort of here in neutral, seeing for the first time. And that very useful having all the ideas put together. Do you want to see Colin while you.
No.
Okay.
Have you really had your plane cancelled this afternoon?
Yes. Yeah, 10:20 last night they cancelled, and then they moved us to half an hour earlier. We've given ourselves
a lot of time.
I got
a friend who from Sale, a friend who is his daughter going on a cruise from Brisbane. So the time we booked the flight, we booked 7 a.m. flight to get there at 9. Hang in Brisbane for the day, get on the cruise from 7 to 9. On RSX time, moved to 12, getting tight. Moved to 1, very tight. We're off to the late flight. And I get some dots at 3:15. Ship's gone.
Sails. Boat is shut.
I'm lucky because I'm a platinum frequent flyer.
Yeah.
And I just bring them up and say, I'm a platinum frequent flyer. Get me on the next
flight. Yeah, get me. And
I normally get some response.
There's a new film from Sale, have you?
Yeah.
It's a big day.
Yeah.
What time did you guys get off? It's really nice. Now, would you guys like a coffee? I'm going to go and do a coffee.
Oh, no, no.
Sure.
No,
Wendy?
No.
Wendy does.
Be a very good thing.
I think we're going.
Yeah, no, I think you're doing really well. And, yeah, it's a big day. They're very quiet. I'm just wondering if it's a bit warm in here for them. And I'm wondering if there's a door up the top of the stairs that we could pop open and just... What do you think we did? So it's fairly up.
I don't know. I'm quite bored.
Yeah. I'm not
bored. I think we can pour some of it.
Yes. So all will chop it.
Yeah, that's the last time you've been
to Yeah, no,
definitely.
I'm going to go get a coffee, Dan. Like
yeah,
that'd be good. What would you like?
You're
going to... Flat white? Okay. I'm going to give a little notice to myself. So I think we're all under control here.
You can
stay in the theatre
call
while
they're
myself here.
Yeah. How are we doing with the
white? Yeah, look, fine. They're not super interactive. There's been about 10 questions so far.
Yeah, I'm not leaving a lot of room.
No, that's right. I think it's nice to have something where there's an advantage to being online.
I think the online kids.
It's different. It's a different experience.
Back to here.
Yeah.
Optimize for video and sound, and we are good to go.
Thank you.
I think I'd do it once by the keyboard before you can use that.
Oh, it's cool,
right? That's what happened before. And it was weird to like click on it or something.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Good.
good afternoon, everybody. Well done. You are a fantastic group. So good at getting yourselves organised, in and out, back on time. It really makes the day go smoothly, and everyone's very grateful. Colin's ready to go. Waves. We're on.
Actually, before we start, I need a little bit of feedback from you, and not from the microphone. How am I going in terms of the level where I'm pitching it at? Okay, am I too high, too low? So hands up those who, or just right. Okay, so hands up those that I'm pitching it where I'm, the level I'm coming in at. Am I too high? Too low? Just okay? All right, fine. That's all I need. What about the speed at which I'm going at? Too fast, too slow, or okay? Okay, too fast? Yeah, all right. Too slow? Yeah, okay. All right, okay. I will try and slow down, but that just means I'll have to take some content out if I slow down. All right, we'll see how I go. And I can't take the jokes out because I need them. Okay, yeah. It's all right. Oh, now I was asked the same question a couple of times during the break, and it's a good question. So I'm going to have a quick 30-second chat about it. And that is, how many exam papers should you do? Okay. I think the question is, how are you going to use the exam papers that you do? And this is about where I think you learn from your mistakes. Since we've had this current study design that you're doing, there have been 10 papers. There's been the 2017 end of year paper, the two 2018 papers, the 18 paper and the NHT paper, two in 2019, 20 we didn't have an NHT, then there's been 21 two papers and 22 two papers. Okay, so there's a total of 10 papers. I reckon if you can do every one of those questions on those 10 papers, you are under control. Okay, and I've given you files to tell you, when you do the papers, you have a look at the file and have a look at what I've done. And if you get the question wrong, then you go and have a look at the theory, and then you go and maybe just practice some of those other types of the same type of question in the different papers. It's being smart and knowing what you know and what you don't know, sort of idea. Which one should you do, and which order should you do them in, and where do the commercial papers fit into the process? I would, and basically everything which I'm saying is actually in the notes, all right? In the introduction, I've talked about this. So don't get too fussed if you're not taking it all in at the moment. I reckon if I never used to let my students see the current NHT paper. Okay, I used to leave it until late in the process, and I would do that as just before the exam, as a really close example of what this year's paper might look like. So if you have done it, that's okay. You can do it again later on. And that's fine too, because one of the processes I used to do was we used to repeat papers, because I wanted them to see how they were improving. So the first time you do a paper, you're actually not going to do really well, because you hadn't been asked to get your head together and do everything in the one session. I think you should, with the bought papers, if you've got access to bought papers, the staff papers and IRATV and all those other ones out there, I'd be doing them, the newest ones first, and working backwards. I'd be doing the VCAR papers, 2017, then 18, then 19, then 20, 21, and then do 22. If you haven't done the 22 paper all by itself, I'd be leaving that to late in the process when you've got as much knowledge as you can, you think you're going to get, and then you do the 22 paper and the 23 NHT paper, and then the things you get wrong should be quite fine detail, so you can sort of see, you know, fairly closely where you still need to do some more work. If you've already done the NHT paper, that's okay, and have a go at it again late in the process, and in theory, there should be a fair amount of improvement in your performance on that, okay? But it's all about, it's not about the questions you get right. It's about the questions you get wrong, okay? That's you've got to change, you know. The kids, when I used to give a sack back, the kids always wanted the mark. I never used to add it up. I said, I don't care about your total. I'm interested in what you got wrong. And when they looked at my mark book, it just showed everything, every mistake that they'd made, because that's where I had to work. Speaking of mistakes, hands up you who have during the year, say, forgotten to square the bottom line when you've done a calculation, all right? You know, nearly everyone should be putting their hands up. Now, who's, all right, there are two types of mistakes you can make on the exam. The first one is what I used to call in my class unforced errors, okay? And that's where, you know, you just stuff it up. They're the ones that are under your control. You've got to manage them. You've got to understand you make unforced errors and you've got to work out some strategies to eliminate them. That's what your cheat sheet's for, okay, to remind you to do that. The other ones are knowledge errors. If you don't, you get the question wrong because you just don't have a clue how to do it. In my class, that always used to be my responsibility. And I used to say to the kids, work out, you know, we used to call them dams in class, dumbass mistakes, okay? And that's what the kids used to make. And they would do the dams and I would do the content stuff that they hadn't dealt with. You've got to take responsibility for your learning now. All right, enough of that. We're going to move on to waves, and we're going to talk about longitudinal waves. You need to understand the difference between a longitudinal and a transverse wave. These are really simple. You need to be able to identify the wavelength from them. We need to understand the nature of waves and how we're going to use them to describe some fairly amazing bits and pieces. We also need to know the wave equation for your Zeekner-Flander. Some of the questions are really simple. Well, I think they're fairly simple. A loudspeaker is connected to a signal generator is placed near a microphone. The microphone is connected to an oscilloscope. The display on the screen and oscilloscope is shown below. VCAR, every now and then, they use a lot of words to say something very simple. Anyway, the student varies, and so that's what they get. The student varies the settings of the signal generator, but the oscilloscope controls are unaltered, which means what the difference is because of the difference in the input. The display on the screen is now shown below, fairly straightforward. What we're getting is, the sound entering the microphone, compared with the earlier situation is now best described as, if we go back and have a look, we can actually see that the amplitude of the signal has stayed the same, so the loudness has stayed the same, but the period has shortened, which means that it must have a greater frequency. I find that fairly simple. It's been asked 6 times in the last 10 papers, and only half the state can do it. All right? I don't think that sort of idea should be too bad, too much in general terms. Okay. The Doppler effect. This comes up every now and then, not altogether that often, but you need to be able to deal with it. And the Doppler effect occurs when the source of the sound is moving. And if the source and the sound is still going to come out in circular wavefronts, but the point, the origin, is actually moving relative to the observer, which is, you know, going to be the person listening to it. As the source moves towards the observer, there is, and I'm going to use the word, an apparent shortening of the wavelength, because the distance between successive crests, or, well, strictly speaking, successive, you know, we can either call them rarefactions or compressions, it doesn't matter, is actually going to be shorter. And so we will get an increase in the frequency that is being heard. The speed stays the same because the medium has stayed the same. It's still in air. So the medium has stayed the same. So if V is equal to F lambda, if V stays the same, but lambda effectively gets smaller, then the frequency must increase. Okay, that's received. All right. When we're talking about waves, the first thing you need to ask yourself is this a standing wave question or is this a traveling wave? Okay, we get a standing wave when we have two identical waves that are traveling in opposite directions in the same medium. And so we will get what is called either standing or stationary wave. And the superposition principle is obtained, is used to obtain the waveform. That's just me adding vectors again. Okay, I love vectors. You'll be surprised how often I can say that during this presentation. If we look at what's going on in a standing wave in a string, we can have a look at the first, the fundamental, which is the picture on the left, and you can see that the length of the string, there is half a wavelength in there. And you can see the envelope that is actually occurring, which is where we're sort of seeing the wave form there. The next time we see that occur, when we're going to have a node at both ends, we've also got a node in the middle, and that's going to give me the scenario where the length is equal to the wavelength. The length L is now a wavelength. Next scenario, I can see that is when lambda, when L is equal to 3 on 2 lambda, and then when L is equal to 2 lambda. Again, I have pictures of these in my head when I'm getting ready for the exam. I don't try remembering formulas and things like that. I've got images in my head, and that's where I come from. The length, so how do we ask this sort of thing? A length of spring is used to demonstrate waves, okay? Set up a standing wave pattern. Okay, that's the first thing we've got to do. We've got a standing wave. At the instant shown, the pattern is at its maximum displacement. Which of the statements A to F best describes the motion of point P at the instant shown? Because it's at its maximum displacement, it is momentarily stationary. In which direction is it going to move? It's going to move downwards, okay? Because we have to end up with this envelope. That's what it's doing, okay? So it's going to move downwards if we get to that particular point. Again, you noticed only just over half the state got that right. I don't think it's that hard. Okay, and what I think is that some kids, they try to make the questions too hard. Okay, they try to read too much into it. We're not like that. We need to also be able to explain what goes on in pipes. And so the scenario is like this. The fundamental, if the pipe is open at both ends, you're going to get a pressure node at both ends. Why? Because the sound isn't going to be capable of changing the pressure of the air in the rest of the room that is actually at the end of my pipe. So you would expect to get no pressure variations at each end. Strictly speaking, it's not at each end. It's a little bit further than each end because there's an end effect, but we don't deal with that, okay? But that's what you're going to expect to get. Nodes of both ends. How do I get nodes of both ends? I've got to have an antinode in the middle. All right. And so my scenarios for pipes open at both ends look exactly the same as a string. Okay. Again, I just have, I just draw pictures and then try and describe what's going on. If the pipe is closed at one end, this is physics all over. What's the opposite to an open end? A closed end. What's the opposite to a node? An antinode. Fair enough. So we're going to get a node at one end and an antinode at the other end. The first time we get that, we get a quarter of a wavelength fitting in the length. The second time we get three quarters of a wavelength fitting in the length, and then we get five quarters wavelengths fitting in the length. I think fairly straightforward. Diffraction is the bending of light as it goes through a gap or past an obstacle. How does it bend? Well, its path was going to be straight, but its path deviates. So we're talking about how far it's going to deviate. When I say bending, I mean deviate. How much does it mathematically, how do we model this? We say that the amount of diffracting, the deviation, the bending, is going to be given by the ratio of lambda over D. We need to be comfortable with using that sort of formula. So how do we test this? A group of students is conducting experiments to study the diffraction of sound. The frequency is 1200 hertz. The width of the gap between the two barriers is 0.5 meters. At some distance from the gap, the students note that the edge of the diffraction pattern is 1.5 meters off the center line. The students increase the frequency from 1200 to 3000 hertz. Which of the following is most likely to be observed? A, I left the answers out fairly deliberately, because when you're doing multiple choice questions, when I was, you know, I was once employed, but I think the word used by the VCAA to write exam questions. And we spent more time working out the wrong answers than we did the right answers, okay? And we put some beauties in there, you know, nice little ones that everyone's going to want to choose. When you're doing multiple choice questions, I think you should read the question, answer the question, and then find the multiple choice option that aligns with your thinking, okay? Don't let me control your thinking by giving you the options. Does that make sense? I think you can use it in most subjects. It gets a bit difficult in maths because that's maths. But they have all sorts of different sort of ways, points which they want you to finish at. But with physics, you certainly should be able to answer the question. So in this case, the students increase the frequency from 1200 to 3000 hertz. If I increase the frequency, what is the wavelength going to do? It's going to get smaller. If the wavelength gets smaller, what's the ratio of lambda over D going to do? Get smaller. So if that gets smaller, what's the pattern going to do? Get narrower. Does that make sense? I've done my thinking. Now I read the rest of the question and the rest of the question. And if I flick through those, which one agrees with me? Okay. And I think we will go to the B to say the edge of the pattern will be closer to the center line. And voila, we're correct. Okay. That's the way I want you to do your thinking with all multiple choice questions. All right. Maxwell. He started our understanding of what light is. If anyone wants to try and tell you they know what light is, you can stop listening. Okay? We don't know what light is. We have some models that explain light. In fact, if one starts saying much about physics and they say they know what's true, we got models that explain what we see. Whether we understand everything that's going on, I'm not in that path. I'm not in that boat at all. Okay, Maxwell gave us some ways to start thinking about how EM radiations operated and what they were. He told us that when you have a changing electric field, it will induce a changing magnetic field. We know that if you have a changing magnetic field, that will induce a changing electric field. So he said that the energy that was light was actually a changing electric field that was creating a changing magnetic field, which was at the same time regeneratingly changing an electric field, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it all travelled at the speed C, and it was mutually perpendicular to all of it. Easy. I think you should have this sort of diagram on your cheat sheet, just so that you just get things into perspective. And if it's on your cheat sheet, you don't have to remember it. I'm not sure what your brain's like, but mine's fairly full. And I think more goes out of it than goes into it these days. So I don't like trying to remember anything. Put it on your cheat sheet. Some of the questions are actually really simple. Which of the following below is greater for red light travelling through a vacuum, there's my key, than for blue light travelling through a vacuum? We know the speed of propagation through a vacuum for all colours is the same, for all frequencies. We should know from here that the red light has a longer wavelength than the violet light. Okay, so it's just going to be the wavelength. And again, you know, when we ask that sort of question, it's been asked seven times, less than 70% of the state can get it right reliably. All right, polarization of light. We polarize, we limit the direction of the electric field. And that, by consequence, limits the direction of the magnetic field, because it's generated by the electric field, the changing electric field. So if we have a polarizing filter, we can only allow a vertical electric field through it. If we then orientate our second polarizing filter 90 degrees to it, no light gets through it. Only transverse waves can be polarized. We need to understand that. And it is, as I said, the electric field that actually gets polarized. How do we ask that question? The axes of polarization of two perfect polarizers are perpendicular to each other, as shown in the diagram. Again, what do we expect is going to happen? Our thinking should be that the light that gets through the first one is going to be blocked by the second one, not allowed to pass through the second one, and we just find the answer that comes up with that. We've asked that question 8 times in this current study design since 2017, and 70% of you get it right. So that's okay. I made a video. Einstein helped me. And he is behind a polarizing filter. So I've got it behind one polarizing filter, and now I'm actually going to put another filter in, and this one's at right angles to it. And if we insert this one, now all of a sudden Einstein virtually disappears. So what do I do now? I put a third filter in between the first two, and Einstein comes back. So when I have one filter like that and one filter like that, no light gets through. When I put the third filter at 45 degrees between the two of them, we now get light get through. I told you I love vectors. So my answer is vectors. The electric field, you don't need to know this, but I like vectors, okay? The initial electric field is vertical. So I get an electric field that's in the vertical plane coming through. I resolve that electric field into two components at right angles to each other. One of them's at 45 degrees. So that one gets to go through the 45 degree filter that's in between the two of them. I get that vector and resolve it into two components at right angles to each other, and now the horizontal electric field can get through. That should impress you about how powerful vectors are when the solution to a light problem is done with vectors. We need to understand refraction of light. It's the bending of light If it goes from a low refractive index to a high refractive index, it's going to be in towards the normal because it slows down. Fairly straightforward. When we have asked this question, we've also expected you to know that if you have an incident ray, some of it is going to reflect. Okay, and the angle of incidence has to be equal to the, or the angle of reflection has to be equal to the angle of incidence. So you need to also be able to do that. If it bends towards the normal as it goes from low to high, then because a wave is completely reversible, it's going to bend away from the normal when it goes from high to low. And if we get the angle right, we call it the critical angle, we can actually get it to bend so that it goes along the surface of the other material, which effectively means it is going to totally internally reflect. You need to be comfortable doing your arithmetic with this. And here last year or the year before, an enormous number of students weren't able to identify what the incident angle was, because we gave you the angle between the surface and the incident ray, and you didn't use the right angle. Again, that's just one of the little tricks that the uninformed, or, you know, those that are panicking sort of make. This question, a little bit more difficult than some of the others. An arrow beam of light passes through materials X, Y, and Z. Which of the following statements about the refractive indices is correct? We know that it, as it goes from material X to material Y, it's bending away from the normal. So it is going from high to low. We know as it goes from Y to X, it bends towards the normal, so it's going from low to high. If we take out the middle person, Y, we can have a look at what's it doing going from X to Z. Because what happens in Y is irrelevant, because it's the angle, you know, you should be able to see that the angles are both going to be the same. It is completely irrelevant what's going on in Y. And then we can organize and we can see that as it goes from X to Z, it actually is going from, it is bending away from the normal. So it is going from high to low. If we put all of that arithmetic together, we can actually find that NX is high, NZ is low, is the next one, and NNY is lower. 64% got that question back in 1982. Yeah, one of the things you might say, I've got a range of questions. Yeah, my exam papers go back a long way. I can actually go back to the 60s with exam papers. So I have quite a few on my poor old machine. We often ask this question these days in the form of an optical fiber question. And we should understand that we want our signal, we want our light to actually stay inside the core. We don't want it out in the cladding, so we want it to totally internally reflect when it gets to the interface between the core and the cladding. This question is just asking us which one we want to do. It's a bit boring because there's a whole lot of calculations to do with this, but we should know that if it's going to bend, we want it to bend away from the normal, that the core should be, the refractive index of the core needs to be greater than the refractive index of the cladding. We do some arithmetic and then we find one of them gave us an angle, critical angle of 81.3, one gave us 82.9, and they asked us to decide which one was closest to 83. Dispersion is the splitting. Again, you know, I might have this picture on my cheat sheet too, so I don't have to think. And it is the splitting of light into its components as it travels through a medium. And the red light is going to travel the fastest through there because V is equal to F lambda. It has the longest wavelength, so it's going to have the, you know, it's going to go through with the greatest speed. And so because it's going through quickly, it bends less. The other way I remember that is I basically just remember red bends less. The only vowel in that is the letter E. And I link that together, red bends less. That's fine. That tidies me up. A mixed beam of red and blue light is incident to a glass prism along the path PQ is shown below. The paths of the emerging beam of red light are marked as W and Y. W is in the middle down the bottom and Y is the bottom one on the right-hand side. Which of the choices A to E could represent the path of the blue light? Well, we know that the blue light is going to, the red light is going to bend less, so the blue light is going to blue more, is going to bend more, which means that when it goes from P to Q, I'm expecting the blue light to have bent more away from the normal than what the red light did. So that means the only ray that does that is the one below the middle one. So that's going to give me, it comes out at the point X. All right. This is straight onto your cheat sheet. I actually, this isn't my favourite part of the course at all because it's just memory stuff. This bit doesn't interest me. Sorry. Coherent light. You need to understand what coherent light is. So have a definition of coherent light and then have a definition of incoherent light. You need to understand what monochromatic light is, which is just a single frequency light. And you need to understand that a laser is going to produce coherent monochromatic light. Fair enough. You need to understand what goes on in the synchrotron. I should be interested in this, but I'm not. And you need to understand LEDs. I know they're of interest, but it's getting too much like chemistry for me, and it's not my area. You have definitions of them. You need to understand incandescent light and be able to give a definition and an understanding of that. I want to move on to where the light gets interesting. And I want to start talking about Young's double slit experiment. There are two experiments which you clearly have been taught a fair bit about, and you need to really understand what they are. Young's double slit experiment and the photoelectric effect. They're the two significant experiments which we talked to you about. Young's double slit experiment is powerful because the only way it can be explained is if we model light as a wave. The photoelectric effect is powerful because the only way it can be explained is if we model light as a particle. So now we have a conflict of interests here. That's okay. We're physicists. We can deal with that. All right. So this is Young's double slit experiment. Young only did it with light. So don't tell me he did it with sound or with lasers or anything. He just did it with light, okay? But it's a wave property. So anything that is a wave will actually have the same properties, okay? So all waves will do what we're getting here, which is diffraction and interference, okay? Because they're wave properties. All right, Young put light into a very small gap. He then had a little bit of light come out through there, and that light, which was now in phase, hit two more slits. So that's how he got the light to be in phase, by having a single point source of light, and then that was incident on two more slits. Now we've got two waves that are coherent. They go through a narrow gap. They diffract. They bend as they go through the narrow gap. So now the waves overlap each other. When they overlap each other, they interfere with each other because they're vectors. So we're going to get this interference effect, which is the vector summation of what's going on there. When we get that, we actually end up with getting on our screen a series of light and dark bands. I would always describe these light and dark bands. I don't actually use the language light and dark when I was teaching my kids. I used to say local maxima and local minima, because if you're saying light and dark in, is the way you've got it written on your cheat sheet that you're going to answer to, then when you're talking about sound, that doesn't make much sense to me, okay? But if you talk about local maxima, local minima, then it applies to all waves, okay? So I would use the language local maxima and local minima. That way you've got one answer that's going to generate, going to solve or explain all of those scenarios. The bit in the middle, the two red lines are the same length. So the path difference from one slit to the middle and from the other slit to the middle, the path difference is zero because the lengths are the same. Because the path difference is zero, I'm going to get constructive interference. The dot point in the study design says that you only need to talk about this. You only need to use the words constructive interference and destructive interference. Just say you're going to get a local maximum because of constructive interference. Don't add more to it. Don't tell me that's when two crests combine, because that's not always true. I get constructive interference when two troughs combine too. So if you, as soon as you start saying this is when two crests combine, nah, you're not right. And you run the risk of losing the mark. So just, and the dot point says, just explain it in terms of constructive interference and destructive interference. Assume the marker knows what they mean. Okay, so that's all you need to say. So that the path difference in the middle is when the path difference in the middle is zero, so we get constructive interference. When I look at this part, the length from the top slit to that spot and the length of the bottom slit to that spot are now different. It turns out the length to the, from the top slit is half a wavelength longer than the other one. So now I am going to get destructive interference, which is going to lead to a local minimum, which on this appears as black. Okay? We need to be able to mathematically model what's going on here, and approximately, we can say the delta x, the length there, can be defined as n lambda l over d. That's, I've got n is equal to 1, but if you're trying to find the distance out from the mid, the central maximum out to the second local maximum off to the side, then n will obviously change to 2. But you can do that. That's fairly straightforward. How do we ask this question? I hope you've all seen this basic diagram because it appears on many, many, many exam papers. Okay, Young's double slit is used, the experiment is shown below. The student reads on a website that Young's experiment supports the particle model of light, explaining with reasons whether the statement is correct or incorrect. We've asked this basic idea for you to explain Young's double slit. We've asked it 4 times in the last 10 papers. Okay. Basically, right. When you're doing an explain question and there's a right or wrong answer, or you're asked whether, you know, Mary or Bob are correct, I would always like you to start your answer with the fact. The statement is incorrect, okay? Don't do the English thing and give me this great, long, lovely essay and then conclude at the bottom that the statement is incorrect, okay? I'm marking this at 2 o'clock in the morning. What I want is for you to tell me the statement is incorrect. Ah, it's put me in the right spot. Now I go and listen to the rest of your explanation, okay? If it's consistent with what you've said, then I'll go with it because you've told me you know what the answer is and now you're explaining it. If your explanation is iffy, because you've told me at the start, I am more likely to go with the positive bits than the negative bits. Does that make sense to you? So when you're being asked something, tell me this is true, whack. And now we go from there, all right? So Young's double slit experiment with light demonstrated interference, which was a wave effect. Okay, diffraction isn't specifically a wave effect. Interference is. Okay, so you've got to hone in on the interference. Young's experiment showed that the light from both slits interfered with each other and produced a pattern of light and dark bands. The interference was both constructive and destructive from the superposition of waves. The particle model predicted that two bands would appear on the screen behind the slits of sharp shadows, which are not observed. That's got you 3 marks. Okay, this question here. I've used this one specifically because 39% of the state could get this right. That's students are studying Young's double slit experiment using microwave lambdas 3 centimeters. Instead of light, a microwave detector is moved along the line PQ and the maximum minima in microwave intensity are recorded. What is the path difference S1Z to S2Z? So we have a look at Z. Well, W is the central maximum. X is the first minimum, so we should know the path difference to there is half lambda. Y is the first maximum, so that means the path difference there is going to be 1 lambda. And Z is the second minimum, so the path difference should be 1.5 lambda. Okay, that should not be complicated to be thinking about. So we're told that lambda is 3 centimetres. So for 2 marks, I'm going to ask you what's 1.5 times 3 and expect you to get 4.5 centimetres. I think that's 2 really easy marks. And as I said, less than half the state could do it. Well, some students, by the time they get to the light section, have run out of energy. Or they're running out of time because they've wasted time doing other questions. You've got to time yourself through it. I'm not going to do that. Oh, no. I will talk. Sorry. I've got to go back in. All right. Yes, I will do this. I want you just to follow the instructions.
This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make? The answer is 13.
Did we get that? Remember that? Good.
But did you see the moonwalking bear?
Go!
We're looking for the physics in our questions, and that's where I want to take us, to look for the physics. Okay. I'm going to keep going. I've finished with that, and I'm now actually moving into the next section, but I will talk about the photoelectric effect. And then we will have a break then, okay? So it might take me 5 or 6 minutes to talk about the photoelectric effect. Okay, we need to understand the photoelectric effect. If you're looking at old questions, you'll find that the maximum kinetic energy was HF minus W because we used to call the work function W. In this study design, we changed it to phi. I'm not sure why. I'd like to say just defies logic, but that would be a bit sick. Anyway, what they discovered many years ago was that they had some photographic plates that were being ruined because they were wrapped up in their plastic to keep them nice and light tight, and they were being ruined, and they were being ruined by some particles hitting them, and they couldn't work out what was happening. They eventually decided that some of the metals that they were using around these plates were actually emitting particles that were getting through their wrapping and were damaging their photographic plates. So they started to explore the idea. They knew this was an energy issue because to get a particle to be released from a material takes energy. So this was an energy issue. So they started off playing around with red filters, and they had dull red light. Nothing happened. Okay, fine. More energy. So they put more energy in by making it brighter light, because our wave, because light is a wave, because Young's proved light is a wave. So that's our belief, that light is a wave, because Young's double slit experiment can only be explained with it. So they put brighter red light in. Nothing happened. I'm sure they said something like, bugger. So then they changed the filter and they put in a green filter. All of a sudden, they got some particles being released. They didn't know what they were, but they got some particles being released. They then made the green light brighter, more particles, fine. They eventually realised that there are electrons being released. That's okay. And initially, when we had the anode, the collector, it was positive. So what happens is that every electron that's released into that vacuum there, the electric field is going to force them over to the collector. So all the electrons are being forced over to there. They then replaced the green light with violet light, and the same thing happened. Good. Wave models, okay, can't quite explain red light yet, but it's a bit of a worry. So then what they decided to do is, instead of having the collector positive, they decided to make the collector negative. So now that we've got the collector negative, not all of the electrons are going to be able to get across to the collector. Why? Because they have to do work against the field to get across to the other side, so to speak, which was to get to the collector. They made the retarding voltage, the collector, more and more negative, and eventually they were able to stop the current. What I want to do is to imagine this. The right-hand side, the electrons are being excited by the light and they're coming off the metal. They're having to roll up a hill, which is the potential, the field that they're doing work against. Can you imagine if I made that hill steeper and steeper and steeper, that less and less electrons would get up the hill? Because for the current to flow, they have to get up the hill and fall over the other side. So the steeper I make that hill, the less electrons that are going to come out. The fact that it didn't drop off straight away is only going to be interpreted as saying that the electrons are coming out of the metal with a range of energies. Okay, and I work out what voltage it takes to stop the most energetic electron from coming out. So this is the first graph which summarizes all of those ideas. Okay, we're not going to get too excited by that graph. We're going to look at this part of the graph. On this part of the graph, what I've got is I've got the collector, the anode, is positive. So that means every electron that gets released from the metal is going to be attracted over to the collector. So making it more and more positive isn't going to change the current, because if every electron's getting across, I can't get more current because every electron's going across. So making it more and more positive isn't going to increase the current. So the current remains constant. If we look at the other side of the graph, what we're talking about now is what's happening here. So, sorry, I'll go back to that previous slide. Just imagine. Let's talk about what's the difference between low light, medium light, and bright light. We've got a greater current when the light is brighter. How do we explain that? We say that the brighter light means that it has got more photons coming in. Each photon is releasing the one-to-one relationship between the photons and the releasing of the photoelectrons. And the more photons we have coming in, the more photoelectrons we're going to get released. So the greater the current. But the left-hand side of the graph tells me that no matter how steep I've made that hill, well, I make that hill a certain steepness, and no matter how much energy those photons have that hit the photoelectrons, how much energy the photoelectrons come out, there's a hill that stops them getting over. And it's the same for all of every intensity of that particular light. So let's look at this graph. We've got the right-hand side isn't of much interest. The left-hand side is telling me that if a green photon can release a photoelectron to get up that hill, if I replaced the green light with blue light, then it takes that hill to stop the most energetic photoelectron from getting up. And if I replaced it with violet light, it took that hill to stop the most. So it is telling me that the energy of the photons depends on the frequency. And that is how I'm going to use it. We have this graph also. And we need to be able to interpret this graph. I'm going to do a little bit of maths on this graph. Okay, we should know that the gradient of the line is Planck's constant, so it always has to be the same. All of these lines have to have the same gradient. For me, even though the chief assessor sometimes puts in the examiner's report, he puts the lines below the horizontal axis as solid lines, I always ask him, what is the definition of negative kinetic energy? Is it going backwards or is it going inwards or something like that? Negative kinetic energy does not exist. Mm-hmm. So the lines for me, your lines below the axes need to always be dashes because they are not data points that you've collected. They're extrapolations. Anyway, that's me ranting. We know that the gradient of the line is given by the rise over the run. So in this instance, the rise is the work function, the run is the length from zero up to F0, so we can get that the gradient or the work function is just going to be equal to HFO, straightforward. If we go back to this graph, I want to look at that triangle there. I like that triangle. I'm going to draw a congruent triangle. So there's my congruent triangle. Now, if I look at my congruent triangle, I can actually read the work function off that graph by just using congruent triangles. When is this useful? It's useful when the question is presented to me in this form and I'm not told what HFO is. I can actually just add my congruent triangle to it and work out what my work function is. Does that idea make sense, how I'm using a congruent triangle to solve this? This question is just a straight out calculation because calculate the work function. We know the work function is equal to HFO. They're telling me what FO is. What you do need to do is you need to be careful of what your vertical axis is, and you need to make sure it is, if it's a voltage, you need to turn it into an energy. Okay, so you just need to be a bit careful with what you're doing here. All right, this question here is, again, a standard question which we're going to ask. What is going on here? And we sketch the graph. And it now says the intensity of light is now reduced. Sketch the new graph on the diagram above. We were looking for the same horizontal intercept, and we were looking for a slightly reduced intensity, so a slightly smaller one. That's what we were looking for. What we were not looking for was this one. And if you're going to present that as your answer, my question to would be to you, which line did you think I might be interested in? Okay, the answer is none of them, because as a marker, I need to know what one you mean. The chief assessor, Andrew, says it is your responsibility to make it clear to me what you mean. It is not my responsibility to interpret between the lines.
literally. Okay? All right. I've gone a little over time, but I think we will have a break until, 6 or 7 minutes, okay, because I want to, the others, the online people, we start at 12. Sorry about that, going over time. All right.
If you can adjust your microphone down a little bit. It's just a little bit of...
Right, okay.
Is it because Colin's a little bit louder this time?
It's also because I switched these around. Break, use that one again.
Oh, yeah, all right.
Okay.
But it was louder, I think, through that one.
Yeah, it was definitely louder, yeah.
Because I put it back to 80%. Like, I dropped it from the nose.
Yeah, all right, I'll just... This one should...
Yeah, that one, yeah.
Yeah, good.
Interesting, it was just slightly pinging on... Yeah, on no, all I his, heard, his, yeah. His sibilance and then... At the same time, I wanted that girl to be up here. So I wasn't sure whether you were just speaking louder.
No.
Hello,
can you
help?
So I can. Don't forget to tell them where the notes are.
Sorry?
Don't forget to tell them where the notes are.
Yes, yes. Oh, I'll get Barbara.
Okay, can I get you anything? Can I get you anything?
Yes.
Hi, everybody. If anyone is interested in some extra food, there is some extra boxes of food out the front if you'd like them and some water. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right.
is just really written so that we're trying to minimise the number of pages. So not because of the inside, but because people and it's really
yes, I'm going to actually say how
that's
worked. So maybe it's one of these.
You don't want another sandwich,
do you? Yeah, because I was going to want to go to the house. Yeah, so it's so easy. Just leave your charge and all works.
No, it's just been lovely to have you. So, yeah.
I'll see you later.
Yes.
And I'll send you a
invoice. Yeah, absolutely.
Including Thursday.
Yeah, no worries. Bye.
I might be here. Do you think we'll have a chance for a few general questions on the floor at the end of this?
Yes, yes.
All right. Just getting off us off to our final session for the day. I think at this point, actually, we should just say a big thank you to Swinburne University because they've made this venue available, which has meant that we can do a great hybrid session, and they've also provided you with this lovely lunch and the tour. So a big round of applause to Swinburne. Checked in with Colin. He reckons that there'll be a little bit of time at the end of this session for general questions from the floor. So this is a good moment to just think a bit, what are those burning questions that you'd really like to have a chance to ask? And if you're scared about asking them in front of everybody, there will also be the opportunity to come down in person afterwards. But often the question that's in your mind is also in a good 90% of everybody else in the room's mind. So it's well worth getting it out there. They'll be very grateful. So handing over to, someone's item left behind that somebody might like to get on their way home. Over to Colin.
Okay. Yep. Got a couple more slides on the photoelectric effect, which are tending to move more into the investigation, but we'll talk about that. Einstein's explanation of the photoelectric effect, Einstein did not do the experiment. So as soon as you tell me he did the photoelectric effect, you're wrong, okay? And you've lost me, okay? And you're going to get me back again. He explained it. Okay, others did it. He gave an explanation for it. And so we're talking about his explanation here. I've given a fairly long answer. And again, everything's in the notes. You know, all of this has just been copied straight out of the notes. The photoelectric effect supports the particle model of light. The following findings were not able to be explained using a wave model, okay? So the fact that it needed a minimum energy, that the energy emitted by the photoelectrons depended on the frequency, and that below the threshold frequency, the increase in the intensity did not produce photoelectrons, okay? None of that can be explained with the wave. And that more intense light was explained as more particles with the same energy, whereas from the wave model, from Young's double slit experiment explained, more intense light would give us a wave of a greater amplitude. So there's a real explanation for what's going on there. I want to talk a little bit about technique here And here's a question where we're going to be, we've plotted the points, the voltage points versus the frequency, and we've got those points. What do you think the very next question is going to be? And the answer is, what's Planck's constant? So it's, what's the gradient of the line? So I've got the gradient, a line in there, find the gradient. That's probably a good line of best fit, but it's a dumb line of best fit. And it's a dumb line of best fit because you now have to find the gradient. So you now have to find the rise over the run. And you don't have any nice points on your line. This is a better line of best fit. Okay, can you see what I've done? I've now moved my line to go through 2 points. I'm not going to take a mark off you on the exam if I don't think your line of best fit is perfect. But I am going to take a mark off you if you find the gradient by not using 2 points on your line. Does that make sense? So make sure your line is a user-friendly line. Or you could do something like that and you could make your line, doesn't have to go through any points, but it goes through 2 intersections of grid lines so that when I'm finding the gradient, I can just use those 2 points to find my gradient and I'm right. All right? So be a bit strategic when you're drawing your lines at best fit. Okay. I hope we've all seen diffraction patterns that look like that. This is where we're trying to show that the pattern that's generated by electrons, which are particles, is the same as the pattern that's generated by photons in the form of X-rays. That's what we're looking for. We know that the diffraction is given by the ratio of lambda over D or lambda over W, doesn't matter. So if the patterns are the same, if we're using the same metal or whatever or spacing in the grids we're getting, then D is the same. So the wavelength of the electrons must be equal to the wavelength of the X-rays. We know that the wavelength is equal to H on P for a photon. So that means that the wavelength must also be equal to H on MV for a particle. So we're linking some ideas together. All right. I have left this table deliberately blank because I think you should have it on your cheat sheet. And as I said to you, building the cheat sheet is the important part. Most of you will spend more time building it than actually using it on the exam. That's okay. I think you should have a table that looks like this. And it's got a table where we've got M is greater than zero and M is equal to zero. And then in this table, I think you should write, and this is where I'd get together with some of your mates, and say, what's every formula we know that gives us the momentum for a particle that has no mass? What's every formula we know for that will give us energy for a particle that has no mass? And fill the table in. The biggest mistakes students make on the exam is they have electrons or some other particle traveling at the speed of light. Because they've used E is equal to HC on lambda, great. But all of a sudden their particle has a mass. And that's where we just go, wrong. There's 2 or 3 marks thrown away. Okay, so be a bit sensible and think about how you're going to do it. I would always recommend that you had the first thing you do, and this is where you practice what you're going to do on the exam so that when you're performing on the day, this is the routine that you've always done in your preparation. Okay, let's go on to some questions here. And again, this has been asked 6 times out of the last 10 papers. In a cathode ray tube, electrons of that mass are accelerated to a velocity of that speed. Calculate the Broglie wavelength of the electrons. This is where kids just want to go, I can work out what its speed is, E is equal to HC on lambda. Good, but it's an electron, so no good. What you have to do is you have to find the momentum of it and then find the wavelength from the fact that you know what its momentum is and that lambda is equal to h over p, and that is where you're going to solve that sort of problem. This question. I'll put this one in. I was a bit doubtful about it, but anyway, I'll talk very briefly about it because the answer's a bit vague. A fine wire mesh, you know the question. We're going to fire some electrons through there and we're going to look at the diffraction pattern. The study design says that the question is are you going to get diffraction? The study design is fairly vague about this, but it says, are you going to get diffraction? And to get diffraction, the gap and the wavelength have to be of the same order of magnitude, okay? It's a bit rubbery around the edges, but if you use the same order of magnitude, roughly the same, then you will get diffraction. In this case, the wavelength was 0.5 millimetres and which is 5 by 10 to the minus 4, and we'd worked out beforehand that the wavelength was 3.6 by 10 to the minus 11 metres. Okay, so 10 to the minus 11 is nowhere near 10 to the minus 4, so you're not going to get diffraction. That's what we wanted you to be able to deal with. A beam of electrons is produced in an electron gun. The De Broglie wavelength for each electron is 0.36 nanometers. You need to be really wary and alert to what units we're using here, because the previous question we had millimeters, now it's nanometers, totally different. An experiment is undertaken to compare the diffraction of these electrons in X-rays. With a similar gap spacing, the diffraction patterns are found to be nearly identical. Calculate the energy of the X-ray, show each step in the working. Yes, that's where you're going to get all your marks, by showing each step. Okay, first mark is for stating what you're going to try and do, basically. And it says, since the two patterns are nearly identical, they must both have the same wavelength. Now I know where you're trying to go with your answer. That set the scene. That's important. Now your arithmetic is to actually just use an equation, and because we're talking about photons, we can go E is equal to hc on lambda, and we do some calculations and off we go there. But even if you can't do the calculation, there is a mark in there for you telling us what the physics is that you're trying to do, okay? So Andrew Hansen, the chief assessor, keeps telling us it's a discursive. He wants you to describe what you're doing. You know, that's what he wants. Okay. Scientists study diffraction of electrons by a crystal lattice. The apparatus is shown in figure A. In this apparatus, the electrons have a mass of that and accelerated to that speed. The electrons pass through the crystal and the diffraction pattern is observed on the fluorescence screen. The pattern is observed in B. Okay. The question is, the students now increase the accelerating voltage and hence the speed of the electrons. Which of the following options would show the pattern? If we've increased the speed, what have we done to the momentum? Increased it. If we've increased the momentum, what have we done to the wavelength? Decreased it. If we decreased it, what have we done to the pattern? Made it narrower. Yes, are we comfortable with that logic? That's what we're doing, okay? That's the sort of thinking. I know I'm going through it quickly, but you can read all of this thinking in the notes, okay? I understand I'm going through it quickly. I apologise for that. Okay, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which is basically just another way of us to look at single-slit diffraction patterns. But anyway, there's not much they can ask on this. Okay, they've struggled to ask them, and you don't need to know the formula. Not part of the study design. What you do need to know, though, is that the more we know about a particle's position, the less we know about its momentum.
So the narrower, so we're thinking in the vertical direction here, which is called delta x, just to confuse you. Okay, so we're thinking in that vertical direction there, and we're thinking as the particle goes through that narrow gap, the narrower that gap is, the more I know about its position in the vertical. Does that make sense? So I know more about its position, which means the less I know about its momentum. So when it comes out, its momentum can be quite high. So it can be anywhere up there, and where it's going to land is wide on my screen. Okay, so that's the image that I want you to sort of be able to do. It is all in the one direction, and a direction is at right angles to the motion of the particle is what we're interested in. Okay, so we're only interested in this question in what's going on in the vertical. Okay, so a diffraction pattern is produced by a stream of electrons passing through a narrow slit, as shown in the diagram below. Okay, this diffraction, the electron diffraction pattern can be used to illustrate Heisenberg's uncertainty principle because knowing the uncertainty, now this is back to where you don't read the answers, you think about it, and it says knowing the uncertainty in the y direction is going to, the more I know about it, it's uncertainty in the y direction as it goes through that narrow gap, the less I know about its momentum in that direction. And that's what we're looking for. And if we go back to the answer B, is what roughly got round to saying that idea. Okay. Absorption and emission spectrum. You need to be reasonably familiar with them, and you need to be able to link the spectrum with the diagram that I've got on the right there. It's reasonably straightforward. We should understand that if it is an absorption spectrum, we're going to get black lines because they're the frequencies that have been absorbed. And if it's an emission spectrum, we're going to get the lines that are being emitted. They're the same. They come exactly from one from the other. Okay. The figure shows the energy levels of a mercury atom. The atom is initially in second excited state. Which one of the following photon energies could be absorbed by this atom and hence excited to the third excited state? This is just arithmetic. This is just, I want to go from 6.7 up to 8.8, sorry. And so I'm just going to add 2.1 EV to it. 65% of the state could tell me that. The visible spectrum of the hydrogen atom is observed to emit photons of energy 2.6. Calculate the wavelength of this emission of the emission spec, this emission spectral line. Okay, again, this is just plug it, what I call plug and play questions. You plug numbers into a formula, you play around with them, and you come up with an answer. Okay, again, it should be fairly straightforward. This formula should be on your cheat sheet. You should be comfortable knowing for photons. And have it's in your M is equal to zero column, and you should be able to go with that. Which one or more of the following photon energies can be emitted by a mercury atom, which is initially in its second excited state? If it's in its second excited state, it can drop down to the first or can drop down to ground. So it can actually emit any of those three. When you're drawing these diagrams, there are a range of ways of doing it. There is the random way, which invariably misses a couple, or there is the technique where I always start. You draw every transition from one level possible, and then you move to the next level, and you draw every transmission possible from there, and then to the next one. If you're just drawing them at random, you're going to miss one. Okay, so have a process and practice it when you're doing these questions. They're not hard. They just require a little bit of discipline in your preparation. Okay, a simplified diagram of the energy levels for a mercury atom is shown below.
explain why a mercury atom, while in the first excited state, is able to absorb a 1.8 photon but cannot emit a photon of this energy. If it's going to absorb a photon, it needs to go from 4.9 up 1.8. So it's going to go up to 6.7. But it cannot go from 4.9 down 1.8. So it can absorb one, but it can't emit one. All right. We have a wave. Okay? Well, that's it. All right. So this is me trying to represent the probability of the electron's position. Okay? Looks like that. When I've got two of them, or when I've got one that's going around and then keeps going around, can you see that those two waves are going to cancel each other out? So what is the probability of an electron being there? Zero. So that is not, the electron is not going to exist in that path because the probability of it being there is zero. So if instead of it going in a straight line, when I have it going around in a circle, let's imagine, I mean, I know my electron doesn't orbit the nucleus. I know it's just a state and it's sort of everywhere at the same time. But ignoring all of that basic thing, can you see that if I'm trying to get this to line up like that, I'm going to end up with them cancelling each other out, destructive interference. That is not going to exist. Whereas if I have them like this and then the probability gets to come around like that, that is going to continue to exist. And that standing wave state will actually exist. So de Broglie suggested that the quantized energy states could be explained in terms of electrons forming standing waves. The problem is, describe how the concept of standing waves can help explain the quantized energy states of an atom. You should include a diagram. Do you think you're going to get full marks for this question if you don't include a diagram? The answer is no. Should you include diagrams in lots of your answers? Yes. A picture tells 1,000 words, uses 1,000 words. You know, just tell me what you're doing. Explain your thinking. Okay. De Broglie suggested that electrons have wave properties such as wavelength, and that the orbits, the energy levels that could exist with those where the wavelength, the electron, set up a stable standing wave. This is consistent with the quantization of energy levels because standing waves have quantized wavelengths. De Broglie said that in a similar way, the wavelength, the electrons orbited in the nucleus must fit into the circumference of the orbit exactly. This only happens with particular wavelengths and therefore energies, and explains why energy levels are quantized. Find yourself an answer that you're comfortable with to this, that you can expand on if you need to, put it on your cheat sheet and have that and use that. Electrons with wavelengths that do not set up standing waves destructively interfere with themselves and cancel out. The standing wave is formed when the circumference of the orbit is a whole number of wavelengths, so 2 pi r is equal to n lambda. The energy of the electron is linked to the wavelength, so lambda is equal to h on the square root of 2 mke. So only because that's just h on p, but I've used p as 2 mke, so from before. So if only certain wavelengths exist, then only certain energy values are permissible. And then I've drawn my diagram showing my n is equal to 3 level. A long answer, but it was worth 4 marks and something that you should have and come to terms with. I want to move on to the practical investigation, and then we're going to have some questions. I've got a bit of finish off, then we have some questions. I'm not actually going to give you any examples on the API because they've all got, there's nothing, they're very hard to find generalized properties with them.
The first question, all right, the first point is, this question is typically worth the most marks for any question on the paper. A lot of students tend to leave it to last, and then if they're running out of time, they rush it. I wouldn't, because there are some really easy marks in here. Plot a few points, draw a graph, do some calculations, plot the points, do a line of best fit. Easy marks. There's normally 6 marks for something like that. And if you're half decent, there's 6 free marks. But don't rush it. If you leave it for rushing, then you've got a problem. If you, personally, this would probably be one of the earlier questions I do in section B on the paper. I don't start at question 1. I start where I like and I do the questions I want to do. So in the EPI section, the first question is most likely to be a recall of a definition. So have some definitions on your cheat sheet and it's just going to be regurgitate question. The second step is usually an explanation about some of the methodology involved in the investigation. And then this is typically followed by an incomplete data set, which requires some further calculation. Okay, so you've done some, you know what I'm talking about. That's the process. The next step is to plot the data. And then your graph is going to typically be scored as this. Correct label of axes, 1 mark. Appropriate scale, possibly 1 mark. It must be more than 50% of the grid. If you try and draw your graph screwed up in the bottom left-hand corner, you've thrown a mark away. Silly you. Accurate plotting of the graph of the points depends on how many points we're going to do. Typically, if you make 1 mistake with your plotting, you've lost 1 mark. If you make 2 mistakes, we might let you get away with it. If you make 3 mistakes, you've probably lost both marks. Okay, so we typically give you a little bit of room there. 1 year, I'm not supposed to say this, but never stop me. The graph, the scale on the kid had obviously been taught that you use the whole of the thing. So each division on the graph went across by something like 2.37, and then they went up in 2.37s going across the graph because they had 10 divisions and they had to fit 23.7 on the whole thing. So they just divided it by that. How dumb was that? I'm sorry, but it was. I actually did the arithmetic, and if the points weren't perfectly plotted, I took marks off because they were making me do work. Okay, so don't get it right. Make it use it. It's user friendly. Make a scale that suits you. All right. Draw the appropriate sized uncertainties on. Okay, so make sure that your uncertainties, and typically they will be either a division or half a division either way. Okay, they're going to be a decent size so that we can see them, because old people like me need to read it. Okay, and my eyesight's not that good. And we will look for a reasonable drawing of an appropriate line of best fit. And it just needs to be half decent. Once the graph is plotted, you'll then be asked or required to interpret it. That normally means you're going to find the gradient, or you're going to find one of the intercepts, or you might find the area under the graph. I mean, that's about all you can do with a graph, okay? You might be asked to extrapolate it, but, this is easy. The final question will be an application-type question based on normally you finding the gradient of the graph or something like that. Understand what we're trying to get you to do. And then when you see the questions, it should make a lot more sense to you what we're trying to get you to do. Okay, so here are some definitions. Have some on your cheat sheet so that you can just regurgitate them when they ask you to vomit them back up again. Okay. I'm not going to go through all of these words. They're fairly straightforward ideas for you to do. Okay. All right.
Ah, yes. Again, I said I'm a visual learner. This is my idea of student data, okay? If it is highly accurate and with high precision, all the data is clustered about the correct answer. If it is highly accurate but low precision, what we're seeing here is you find the average of all those values there, they're exactly right, but there's a range in the values. If you look for high precision and low accuracy, you can sort of see the data is tightly grouped, but it's wrong. And the bottom one, low accuracy, low precision, I just call that typical student data. You need to understand the difference between random error and systemic error and the impacts of them. If you talk to my mate Theo Hughes, he will yell loudly at you about people wanting to say that taking more data reduces error. No, it doesn't, because your error is based on your maximum values, the range of your values. If you take more data, the range is only going to increase. It reduces the effect of the random data, but it does not reduce the error. Okay. Uncertainties. Every time we take a measurement, there is an uncertainty associated with it because our measuring devices have limitations on it. The typical one for you is going to be you look at the smallest division on the device that you're using, whether it be an ammeter or a ruler or whatever it is, and it's plus or minus half of that is your uncertainty. Okay, that's our accepted uncertainties. I've talked about doing the past exam papers. You get them off VCAT website. That's pretty straightforward. The NHT papers tend to be a little bit harder to find. They're there. You just got to scroll down to go looking for them. Okay. I'm going to finish off in about 5 minutes, and then I'll give you time for questions. What have you learnt today? For those of you that have learnt a lot, good. For those of you that haven't learnt very much, fine. That means you're in a fairly good spot to start off with. What I hope, and I've not tried to teach you the whole course, you know, I've just jumped through things and I've gone through at 100 miles an hour. I understand that. But I tried to set you up to show you where to go and things that you might be looking out for. This is you going into the exam. Okay. If you are well prepared, you will survive it. You need to be well prepared, and this is called battening down the hatches here, and we certainly have them, and we will survive. Preparation is the key. Okay. I was asked earlier on, am I okay to write in pencil? And the answer is yes. Just make sure it's legible. But I never used to allow my kids to write in pencil. If you're in my class, you write in pencil, I basically would pick it up and throw it away. Write in pen. Why? Because when I ask students, why do you want to write in pencil? The answer is because if I make a mistake, I can rub it out. And for me, that's wrong. Because that's saying to me, I'm writing my answer, then I'm thinking about what I'm writing. Oh, bugger, that's wrong. I'll rub it out and start again. No, think before you write. So discipline yourself with a pen. I can't rub this out, so I'm going to think about what I'm doing before I do it. It's a discipline, and I think it works really well.
Don't use an erasable pen.
Pardon?
Do not use an erasable pen.
Do not use an erasable pen either. Yeah. Okay. If you can see that, I'm not sure how well that's coming up on the screen, but there are about 20 dolphins surfing that wave. Right. Enjoy life. Even though you're getting ready for your exams, every now and then there's going to be something good that goes well for you. Make the most of it. Enjoy it. You need to have confidence in your own ability. So work towards, and you get confidence by knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know. That's setting the parameters that gives you confidence to work within those boundaries. You want to push the boundaries out as far as you can, but you need to know what you know and know what you don't. I want to talk to you about being prepared. What I've tried to do today is to spell out the sorts of things that can happen. And you want to be, you want to not, when you go to the exam, there should be no surprises. All right? Everything you go, you should say, yeah, I was expecting that, or that doesn't surprise me. If there are surprises, that suggests to me you're not prepared enough. Okay, so there should be no surprises on the exam. I want you to balance your workload. I want you to be sensible about what you're doing. I want you to, believe it or not, I want you to sleep well. I want you to eat well. The research shows that students that get, they did an experiment in the States quite a few years ago, where they had different processes, and one cohort were effectively made to sleep for 1 hour less than the others. And the ones that slept the hour more every night did several grades higher on their exam. The whole point, the logic being that if you're trying to ram knowledge into your brain, which is what you're all trying to do, it needs time. Your brain, your body needs time to sort the information. It sorts it when it's not busy doing other things, and that's called sleep. So if you give your brain time to let the information go in and find its spots, then it is somewhere where you can get access to it. All of you, I am sure, like me, have actually burnt the candle at both ends, and you've got up the next day. The information's there, but it's come out jumbled. It's not where you wanted it to be, and you couldn't remember it. That's because your brain hasn't had time to put it in its spot. You give your brain time to put things in spot by sleeping. Okay, so you are not going to learn much more in your 8th hour of studying compared with, you know, you're just not going to learn much more. Your brain's going to be full. You will get more value by having an hour's sleep. Okay, sleep is a really powerful learning tool. I'd like to leave you with a couple of thoughts. I'd rather be a human doing than a human being. And that's the way I want you to attack the exam. Don't let things happen to you. Go out there and make things happen around you, okay? Be on the front foot and really get serious. And one of the other things is I want you to remember that a goal without a plan is actually basically just a wish. And I've tried to today set you up into an environment where you can see that there's a direction that you can go that is actually going to improve your performance. That's where I've tried to be. If you have any questions about today, you can actually, we'll do some questions from the floor now. You can speak to us up the front, or you can ask your teacher. And we would actually... Vic Physics, I mean, I know we charged you for this, but it really wasn't much. And we're looking for some feedback in terms of how
how Vic Physics as an organisation can assist students. We do a lot of work assisting teachers, but this is one of our little entries into trying to target students in the system. We value your feedback. We really do. So we would really like you to deal with that. I've finished, Barbara. And we've got 10 minutes which we can deal with questions. Yes.
So, well, first of all, a big thank you, Colin. For your effort, but also I think we should just have a quick thank you for those behind the scenes, the online answerers that you can't see, as well as Wendy, Sandor and myself have been assisting you. Sophia, the wonderful team from Swinburne, there's about a dozen people who've made all this happen for you. So a big round of applause to them. If you've got a question, please raise your hand and Sandra or Wendy will come.
The multiple choice question with the energies emitted, it had like two answers, like B and D. How do you know in like the exam that you can circle two answers? Or like there's the multiple energy levels. There was like 1.8 electron volts.
So
all those like that apply to it. Like it's a multiple choice, right? So usually multiple choice questions have one answer.
Sorry. you may not have noticed, but I wear hearing aids and I really struggle to hear. Yeah, even with the loudness. Okay, Barbara.
So the question is, sometimes there's more than two answers. How do you know? You've really got to assume that there's only one. It's a mistake in the question if there are two acceptable answers. You should assume that it's only one.
Multiple choice questions only have one answer. There might be two that are eventually get accepted, but you only do not put two in a multiple choice question. If it is in the body of the paper, you would expect it to say one or more answers. Okay. If it doesn't, then if it doesn't, you'd be worried about doing more than one answer. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Good. Good.
Any other questions?
Sorry, I'm probably going to have to get the questions translated, but don't get fussed. That's just old age.
For the questions regarding diffraction, you said that if it's in the same order of magnitude, it diffracts significantly. But in our textbook, it says it has to be greater than or equal to one, the ratio.
Did you hear that? It's not part of the study design that you need to know that ratio, okay? And so you're not going to get a question that specifically is around there. You know, if it's about the same, it'll diffract, okay? That's all you need to know, all right? It's not part of the study design, the actual numerical values.
The textbook is referring to a hangover to when those questions referred to sound, and when you wanted to look at serious diffraction from sound, generally that was correct. Anyone who's done any experiments at school looking at the diffraction of light will have noticed that it doesn't have to be one. It can be less than one. You'll see observable diffraction from about 0.1. So just sometimes the books aren't quite up to date with the study design.
Where can we access the notes from this?
The notes are all on the Google Drive. Some of you, there's been a few issues with your email addresses, so please come and see me and we'll sort it out if you haven't managed to access it. So I believe I've given everybody who's registered access, but I'd really like you to test it and come and see me afterwards.
If you're still having problem, get your teacher, just
get you to, or contact Barbara through the email the way you've already contacted her. Let her know who you are and we'll deal with it, okay? Everything, our whole point is to get the information out to you.
Just very quickly, like, will they stay open, like the Google Drive, will it stay open for until exams and stuff?
Yes. Yeah. The resources will all remain available to you until well after the exam.
Sandra?
Adding on to the diffraction question, if we were asked to like prove whether there was going to be significant diffraction or how wide or narrow it was going to be, if we were to show that it's greater than or equal to one, would that be sufficient proof? Or
yes.
Yeah, so it's all right.
Any other questions? There's a question. One of our online contributors has asked, what's the least confusing way of approaching circular motion questions?
Okay, circular motion, for me, the net force is always radially inwards, okay? So don't try using up, down, left, right or anything like that. Keep it simple and say the net force is radially inwards. The net force is going to give me rise to F is equal to mv squared over r. Then I'm going to need to deal with some arithmetic from F is equal to mv squared over r. But start from the concept that the net force is always radially inwards. Okay? Horizontal circles, they should be fairly straightforward. They're typically just application of F is equal to mv squared over r and what is the direction of the net force. Vertical circles, we talked about that and I showed you the diagram. That's the next one. If you're asked to define why it's moving in circular motion, then you need to talk about the fact that there is a constant force. You've got to stress constant force. Don't just say a force, because if the force isn't constant, the motion isn't going to be circular. Okay, so you can say a constant force is acting at right angles to the direction of motion or at right angles to the velocity. Okay, and that is when we get that scenario, we end up with circular motion. So that's dealing with electrons traveling through magnetic fields and things like that. Okay, so there your explanation.
Can I just give a tip on the Google Drive is that incompatibility with Google Docs and Word means that you're better off downloading it as a Word document. Some of the things are whack.
Good tip. So Shanna's just pointing out that to get those resources in a useful form, download them. So the link will allow you to download them. If you just try and look at them on the screen, they're probably going to not format very well because they have a lot of diagrams in them.
Okay. I'd like to...
Question. All right, you had some formulas up there which were different to some formulas which I've written down here, just differently written and different values put in. Will you get marked down if you use a different formula that might be a derivative as like the first line?
No.
All right.
As long as your derivation is correct, I don't care what formula you use. In fact, sometimes I prefer it if you cut out and go straight to the guts of the question. But no, as the only risk with derived formulas and, you know, variations and things like that is if you've mucked it up, then you're up the creek, okay? But you can, as long as the formula is correct, we're fine. Okay.
So, one final question from the onliners. Would you recommend that we handwrite our cheat sheet or type it?
I'd always, or everything I produce is typed because my handwriting is illegible. And I could easily have done all of those examples we did about bad handwriting. And my kids in class used to, you know, the drawings were even worse than the handwriting. So, no, it doesn't matter. It's, for me, when I encourage my kids to do it, I used to say, do take screenshots of your notes and things like that. And then with the screenshot, you can actually change the size of the image fairly easily to move it around on your cheat sheet and to have it where you wanted it to be. So, and I would have all of my, I would have my cheat sheet organized with everything in the same, all of the momentum stuff together. You know, I mean, that's pretty obvious, but I would have it like that and do things like that.
So I think that really brings us to a close. If you could make sure that you drop your name tags back on your way out, you're welcome to come down to the front and ask a few more burning questions if you got them, or come and see me about the drive.